Good afternoon, everyone. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, sorry about the delay in starting. I really hate starting late, but had a couple of delays, including wanting to make sure we had copies of things out to members. Members, just as a reminder, we're going to have the Ways and Means meeting convening at 1 o'clock on Monday. The plan will be to take up the higher education bill and the public safety bill, and the 24-hour rule will be in effect for that. Amendments would be due at 5 o'clock tonight. If members have got a problem with that, I guess let me know, but we should be able to have the 24-hour rule for those bills. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you also have listed in addition to the bills the budget resolution?
Yes, sir.
And at least when you and I talked this morning, those numbers weren't yet put together. Will the numbers be posted? Or maybe they are. I've been busy until this meeting started. But if, and I don't know that we have any plans for an amendment to the budget resolution, but if we did, when will that be posted relative to the 5 o'clock deadline for amendments then?
Well, we would be planning on posting it at 5 o'clock today, Representative Carlson. But if you, we will be taking up the budget resolution. If you have some changes that you'd like to suggest to the budget resolution, of course, those would be in order.
At 5 o'clock tonight.
Well, by 5 o'clock tonight. Yeah, Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if an amendment goes in at 5, don't we have some period after that to do amendments to the amendment?
We don't have an amendment to the amendment rule in committee, Representative Kahn.
So that means that any amendment to the amendment is okay?
Representative Kahn, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
And I, you know, we haven't talked about the budget resolution for Monday as a group from our side the aisle, and I just wanted to make sure that if, you know, and I don't know that we've got anything on the planning board, but if we did, that there would be that opportunity to respond in some way if we chose to. So you're telling me that an amendment to the amendment would be in order right up through Monday then, apparently?
Yes, Representative Carlson, it would be.
And if something does develop, we'd try to give you a heads up. I don't know if the members on my side know yet, but we did put notice out that we're going to try to get together Monday morning and talk about the two bills that are up.
Sure.
So that won't be a conversation until Monday morning because things are breaking rather fast. So we'll be doing that, but we would, if we did have an amendment, let you know as soon as we could.
Okay, yeah, and members, I guess, so, you know, we want to, for the sake of the public, be able to post amendments early if we can. As we get into this next week when we've got all sorts of bill referrals happening, I'm guessing most of the time the 24-hour amendment won't be in order just because of the timing of the bills that we're going to be getting off the floor as they're referred from other committees. But we want to be able to give the public notice when we can, and so I guess in this case, I think with us not the meeting until 1 o'clock on Monday, we certainly would be able to allow the public to have 24 hours notice on those bills. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions. I didn't bring the hearing aids today, so I wanted to check. You said what time are we meeting on Monday?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
Yep. Sessions at 11. I guess I figured that gives everyone time to have lunch after session before we go in.
And then, Mr. Chair, as I was looking on the website today, you had posted for a while the A-72 amendment, then it came down. So has the A-72 amendment been pulled?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition, posted on the website, it does say that we're meeting at 11:30, but it also says that Representative Cornish's public safety bill will be heard on Monday as well. So is it not your intention to hear that bill either?
Well, I think I did say public safety and higher education on Monday, didn't I?
I misheard.
Okay. All right. Yes. Public safety and higher education on Monday. Those are the two bills, plus a change in the budget resolution that we'll be hearing on Monday.
And the 5 o'clock deadline for all amendments are for all of those items?
Yes. Other questions? All right. Members, I've got the minutes of April 16th in front of us. Would someone like to move the minutes? Representative Carlson moves the minutes. Are there any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? See none. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we've got the budget resolution. We've got House File 606. I think maybe in deference to Representative Keel, who I assume is going home this weekend and has a long drive home, maybe we'll take up her bill right now since she's here instead of doing the budget resolution. So, members, I will move that House File 606 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Keel, I know you've got a couple of amendments here, the A6 and the A7 amendment. Do you want to explain your bill first, or would you like to have me move those amendments?
Can we explain the bill real quickly and then move
sure.
it to amendments?
All right. Please explain the bill, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 606 is intended to achieve a safety standard that we seek for our similar to our outpatient surgical centers. Women seeking help for abortion expect to find a safe and comforting place when life has taken a turn that they are not able to handle on their own. Looking for advice first to confirm a pregnancy and then to looking to terminate a pregnancy. They seek out to help from an abortion facility. Already stressed and emotional, these women and young girls assume that this facility has been licensed by our state. We're here to talk today about the ability to license an abortion facility that would provide 10 or more abortions each month. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the two amendments.
Well, Representative Keel, I should say, first of all, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't think you've been before us before. But
no, I have not.
Representative Keel, why don't I move the A7 amendment first? That, I guess, and perhaps you can explain the A7 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can. Members, we would be removing the a requirement for a facility to... that doesn't obtain a license to remove the misdemeanor and then also the fine of $300. And that's what that consists of.
Okay, so this removes the fine. Members, is there discussion to the A7 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed?
We're here.
Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted. Members, now we've got the A6 amendment. Chair will move the A6 amendment. Representative Keel, can you explain the A6 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Mr. Marks would explain the changes here.
All right. I guess it is a money-type issue. Mr. Marks, can I have you explain the changes in the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, the A6 simply takes the appropriation, appropriation currently in the bill is $63,000 in fiscal 16 only. This is an ongoing program, and so there needs to be appropriations in each year. The A6 takes the appropriation, splits it between the 2 years, and adds $1,000 to it to make it even. So essentially that's it. It's appropriating $64,000, $32,000 in each year. This also establishes then a base in future years.
All right. Members, any discussion to the A6 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I wonder, Mr. Marks, if you could just explain, as I was looking at the amendment, I thought that it didn't put a base in for future years. Could you just explain that a little bit? So, obviously, if this bill was to become law, this is a program that would have to be funded year after year after year, right? And I'm just not understanding how the amendment does that.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there's language in Chapter 16A that says that the base for future years is the appropriation in the second year of the biennium. So by putting an appropriation in fiscal year 2017, that will become the base for fiscal 18 and 19. So that's how it
it's current law that achieves that by putting an appropriation in fiscal 17.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson, had you had your hand up?
I did have another question, but I'll wait on that one. But I assume then this is coming out of the other bills category.
Representative Carlson, yes.
And
although actually this is a special revenue fund, excuse me.
Oh, this isn't general fund. Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. So this wouldn't have any impact on. Okay, thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A6 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, discussion to House File 606 as amended. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Representative Keel, I have a question about how one specific line on this would be defined, and then I might give you a particular example, and that's line 2.16. After I hear your explanation of it, I might ask for some further comment.
Representative Peel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, how I would see conduct or practices detrimental to the welfare of the patient would be in terms of not having having a medical procedure done and not having a medical personnel there, assistant. It probably wouldn't be the doctor that would be doing it, but it might be a nurse that would be assisting if they would have somebody in administration show up and help because they're lacking people. That could be detrimental to the patient. Also making sure that they are in prepared to go home, to make sure that they've informed them on what they need to know when leaving, just like we would if we were going to outpatient surgical and we're reviewing all the information we needed before we went home after a procedure.
Representative Kahn?
I guess what I was interested in is what if the decision, for example, what if the the thing I'm specifically interested in is what if the decision not to do an abortion means that the person can no longer bear any children in the future. Is that considered to be a practice detrimental to the welfare of the patient?
Representative Keel.
Explain it again to me.
Representative Kahn.
The decision is made for various reasons not to do an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And that decision results in the woman being unable to bear children at any time in the future. Is the that considered a decision that's detrimental or a practice detrimental to the welfare of the patient?
I would think that that was something that she would be discussing with the physician and they would sign off on. I mean, that's not something you would know until later on. So, no, I don't, and I should say also that this language is taken from the wording for the licensure for outpatient surgical centers.
Okay. I guess the answer is you don't know.
Okay. Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have had the pleasure of hearing this bill now, I think, for the third time, and it has not improved. This bill, I think, is just simply plays politics with women's lives and their health. It is really not about health. First of all, it has it only applies to a clinic that does 10 or more abortions a month, and that's an arbitrary limit. So if this was really about health, why would we have such a limit? And I don't know, maybe Representative Keel will want to address that later. It's really a rhetorical question. It doesn't make any sense. If they're doing 9, surely the women are as entitled to have a safe facility as if they're doing 10 or more. So there's that right there. Secondly, I think it's very clear what would happen under this bill. Imposing the licensing of an outpatient surgical center imposes a lot of things that really are very expensive for clinics to change, and that really don't relate to the women's health in these circumstances, and would result in possibly closing 4 out of the 5 clinics that do abortions in Minnesota. The result of that is sending desperate women back to back alley abortions, things like sepsis, and perhaps to death. So when you close the safe facilities that have a great track record in Minnesota, and by the way, this is a very safe procedure, you are putting women's lives and health in great danger. Now, let's be clear, an outpatient surgical center is a lot of things are done in clinics in Minnesota that you would consider surgical. Most abortions are not surgical, but things like vasectomies, tubal ligation, dental surgery, and even amputations can be done in clinics in Minnesota that are not licensed as outpatient surgical centers. So this is not about health. If this was really about needing to increase the licensing and change the facilities for health, why in the world would you not do that for places that are doing vasectomies, tubal ligation, and dental surgery? This is not about health. The MMA says that this is not about health, and I would just like to read a paragraph from their letter. They say the MMA is unaware, this is the Minnesota Medical Association, is unaware of any specific evidence in Minnesota of substandard care in clinics that provide pregnancy termination services. Likewise, the MMA is not convinced that patient safety is advanced in any meaningful way as a result of the licensing requirements established in this legislation. Finally, the MMA is concerned that the adoption of this legislation could interfere with the provision of care for pregnant women. So I think it's very clear, members, that, I mean, everybody knows how they vote on these abortion bills. This is just a run-of-the-mill anti-abortion bill. If you want to vote for it, to just send a message about how anti-abortion you are, that's one thing. But no one really should be saying with a straight face that this is to protect women's health, because it isn't. It's simply about abortion politics, and in fact, it places women's lives and health in danger.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, if this bill were to become law, it's 100% certain that there would be a lawsuit and that the state would have to defend that lawsuit. I mean, there are two obvious theories or reasons to do a lawsuit. One is the denial of equal protection, and I won't go over that because Representative Liebling just did, and then the undue burden on women. And she went over that too. But my question is, since it's 100% certain that there would be a lawsuit, why do you not have the money in here to fund the defense of your bill?
Representative Keel.
My question would be, do we make that presumption on other bills, that if we think there's going to be a lawsuit, we provide the funding for a lawsuit? I don't know. I'm asking.
Representative Wagenius.
Oftentimes, there is a question that there might be a lawsuit, but there isn't any question here. There will be a lawsuit. It always happens when bills like this come up. That's 100% certainty. So I'm asking why you didn't include money to defend the very provisions you're trying to put in law.
Okay. Representative Keel.
Because I guess that's not something I would see happening. I'm not sure that it would be 100%. I mean, that's a guess, and... I didn't recognize that it would be 100% for certain.
So. Members, I should mention that while there isn't money for defending a lawsuit in the bill, and I'm not sure that that's a normal occurrence that we have, the fiscal note does assume that there will be one appeals hearing every 2 years with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and so there is money in the bill to contemplate a hearing on perhaps a license challenge or something at that level. Representative Wagenius.
That's entirely different than a lawsuit challenging the bill itself. And that's challenging the licensure, which would, of course, go through the Administrative Procedures Act. This would go to our judicial system. And Representative Keel, I find it...
Yeah, and Representative Wagenius, I was not saying that that was the same. In fact, I think I specifically said it was not the same at the beginning of my comments. I just wanted to, since we are talking about finances here and we were, I guess, in general talking about potential challenges, I wanted to bring people's attention to something related to that being in the bill. But I guess I don't see any money put aside in the fiscal note for lawsuits, although I'm not aware of that being a regular thing that we put into bills. I think that that's something that the Attorney General has their budget for to defend us if that in fact happens with bills that we pass. But Representative Wagenius, go ahead. I had just wanted to, I didn't mean to get into the middle of your discussion with Representative Keel. I just wanted to point that out in the fiscal note. But go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
Well, you... You bring up an interesting issue. You're saying that this would be defended by the Attorney General, yet you're cutting the Attorney General's budget and something that's going to be 100% certain that there would be a lawsuit on it. You would think that you'd provide money to defend it. And I'm just pointing out that I think the fiscal note is not accurate, and it's just I'm pointing it out. I think it's strange that you don't want to defend your bill. So, most my comments.
All right, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, my understanding that these are designated as physician clinics and they're regulated under the physician licensure rules that are already in place from the Board of Medical Practice. And furthermore, you know, there are pretty rigorous standards from the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Association, HIPAA, OSHA. So these are already very, very highly regulated institutions. As Representative Liebling pointed out, they have a very, very strong track record. So, like, is this, I just don't understand why we would just be adding more regulation for something that's already very highly regulated, both at the state level and the federal level. Can you comment on that?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, excuse me. First of all, abortion clinics are not, abortion facilities are not licensed. And outpatient surgical centers have conditions of licensure, and that's the comparison. Conditions of licensure for outpatient surgical centers must provide nursing care. This is read out of the statute. And but not limited to the Association of Operating Room Nurses and American Nurses Association standards. And they have to, that's part of the licensure. And there's also other requirements within the surgical center that we're asking for them to be. Abortion facilities are really kind of outside of medical care observation as opposed to most of the and of all the outpatient surgical centers that we have.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm struggling with that because that seems to contradict the fact that these practices are regulated by the Board of Medical Practice and the Board of Nurses. So I think they are included, but this seems like a solution in search of a problem. I mean, I don't think we need this, and I would encourage members to vote no.
Representative Liebling, did you have another question?
I did, Mr. Chair, and there was a discussion earlier about lawsuits and potential lawsuits, and I just wanted to point out to members that this bill has a severability clause, and maybe I could just ask Representative Keel to explain if it's not expected that this bill is going to be challenged in court, why have a severability clause?
Representative Keel. I think you're looking at page 2, line 33. Is that correct?
That's right,
Representative Liebling.
Yes, subdivision 6 of the bill.
Okay. Representative Keel.
I believe that's part of the bill and the protections for the and I suppose there is a risk of it, so it's put in. My guess is it would be put in for other bills also.
Well, Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I don't see this usually. It's very rare to see a severability clause in a bill unless it's an abortion bill. And unless people are trying to do something that they know the courts have frowned upon before and they want to, and they know that it's going to be challenged. So I think there's a little conflict in what you're saying, Representative Keel, and I think when you have a severability clause in a bill, you are expecting that somebody's going to challenge it. This same policy has been challenged in other places. I don't have the data in front of me, but I believe there have been, it has been found unconstitutional and overturned in some places, maybe upheld in some other places. So this is definitely an issue that is going to be challenged if it would become law. And so, I guess I would just ask Representative Keel, I'm not really clear on your position on this. Are you expecting that it would not be challenged in court?
Representative Keel.
You know, I think there's a lot of things that can be challenged in court. There's a possibility, sure. However, I find it ironic that I hear all the time about how safe abortion facilities are. I hear the number 99%. And you're telling me it's so safe we don't need to license it. However, you're questioning we're going to have lawsuits right off the bat. We're going to have people challenging. If it is that safe, then they should have no concerns.
That's not where the lawsuit will be.
Well, Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, that just makes no sense to me, Representative Keel, what you just said. The problem is that by forcing them to be licensed to a different standard, they will close because they will be unable to afford to meet the new standards. Therefore, they will not be there to serve the women they now serve. That's the problem with the bill. So that is why your bill puts women's lives and health in danger, because they will not have a safe facility that they have now. They will be pushed back out to back alley abortions, which are terribly dangerous, where women used to bleed to death and lose their lives and lose their fertility, because desperate women will always get abortions. And by making abortion illegal, you would not stop it as it was not stopped before Roe v. Wade. Women used to die trying to get abortions because some women will be desperate and will go that route. And so what we have now, much as some people don't like women making their own decisions with regard to this, and as much as some politicians would like to interfere in the private lives of women and not allow them to make their own decisions, at least there are safe facilities available for those women who want to do so. And what your bill does is close down those facilities and push women back out into the street to find an abortion the best they can. That is what it does. So my question to you, though, is if you don't think that this is going to be challenged, this is why it would be challenged, because you are closing down women's legal access to abortion in a safe setting. That is what you are doing here. And so naturally, if this would become law in Minnesota, it would be challenged. I just can't imagine how it wouldn't be. If you don't think that would be the case, then you shouldn't have a severability clause in this bill.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd just like to respond to a question that Representative Fornstein had regarding this. In the comparison between an outpatient surgical procedure, which you might go to for, let's say, an arthroscopic knee surgery, where you would have an invasive procedure with anesthesia that would require have a certain set of requirements that would have standards for cleanliness, standards for patient prep and post-op care, so that you can have the procedure and be taken home and be in a protected manner, sanctioned by the state of Minnesota. The majority of abortions that are performed in Minnesota are an invasive surgical procedure. They are coded and billed as such, where there is a significant risk for infection and blood loss and hemorrhage. And aftercare is very, very important. Representative Keel's bill just simply seeks to put the same standards for medical care and cleanliness and patient care to protect folks as you would have if you were going to get your knee fixed at an arthroscopic surgery at an outpatient surgical center. That's the comparison. So I don't understand why there would be a necessity that these clinics could not adhere to the same standards, the same health standards that other outpatient surgical centers do for, quite frankly, less dangerous procedures.
Representative Hornstein, since your name was mentioned, I'll go to you.
Just very quickly, I think it's important for the record, and I think Representative Liebling referred to this. I mean, the American Medical Association, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists oppose these bills, and you know they're the physicians. They're the ones that you know took an oath to protect the lives of their patients. That's their job, and I think it the problem with this this bill and others that are similar is that you know when politicians try to play doctor, I think it we run into trouble, and that's what's going on here. So. You know, I'm going to trust the physicians who, you know, that's their job. Their patients' care is absolutely primary for them, and they oppose this. So I think it's dangerous for us to get between the patient-doctor relationship and to play doctor.
Representative Hillstrom, then Cornish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, can you tell me why this didn't go to the Civil Law Committee? Because you are determining the standard of proof. You are laying out what the hearing is supposed to look like for any suspension, revocation, and refusal to renew the license. You have the severability clause, and I see, looking at the list, that it did not go to the Civil Law Committee, and the Civil Law Committee hears all of these bills.
Representative Keel.
I wasn't aware that it needed to go there, and there was no recommendation that it should go there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, is there a language relating to, what is it, Chapter 13 on here that you see?
Mr. Chair, I have not seen Chapter 13, but I do have page 2 or line 2.22 where it talks about the hearing and it talks about the burden and who has it and what it is. Those kinds of bills always go to civil law. Mr. Chair, I was originally going to raise the issue that it should have gone to public safety as well, but she took out the provision that concerned me about public safety, and so I don't think that it's appropriate to have gone there. But these are the kinds of bills that we always hear in civil law. When you're talking about who has the burden to prove what and what the civil process is to suspend someone's license or take it, those are all the issues that we always send to civil law, and that's where it should appropriately go.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, member, I'm sorry to have to dice up the meeting a little here, but I have to respond to your typical liberal diatribe garbage that I hear. And I don't mean that from any certain member here, so it's not an insult, but whenever this subject comes up, we hear the drama come out about backyard abortions, car abortions, coat hanger abortions, and if these people had just one bit of sympathy, as they do for the mother, or they do the baby that's being aborted, the millions of kids that have died, it's just unbelievable. I adopted my first son, And thank God that his mother was mentally challenged, living with the grandparents and poor. She fit all the qualifications that your typical abortion people would walk up to and say, you need an abortion. It'd be a good idea for abortion. This kid's going to end up in welfare or crime. You should abort the kid and live your life and get an education. And they could have told her that very easily. She could have made that decision. But she didn't. And now I've got a son that has given me 5 kids, and I'm proud of every one of them. And I got 12 grandchildren. I think of all the grandchildren that would be here today if we weren't killing them. And to call one of these centers safe, there's nothing safe about any of these centers. There's always a risk. You go in anywhere. You go to a hospital, you're better staying out of them. If you weren't sick when you went into them, you'll be sick when you go out. But so there's always a risk. And the lawsuits, I feel bad for the mothers would probably want to sue the doctor that performed the abortion when she was a young mother, and she grows up and wishes to God she hadn't got that abortion and is sorry for it every day, and you see them all over. And that's why we have the counseling before we go in. So I just wanted to give you the conservative side of the argument. If we have to live with abortion, we do. Roe versus Wade, now we got to live with the horror of abortion, but at least we can make it as safe as we possibly can if we're going to have to live with the horror of it. So that's it.
Okay, I've got Representative Carlson, Hillstrom, and Liebling. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, why don't I yield to one of the others first, my question, and wait a bit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you,
but I'd
Mr.
like
Chair.
To remain on the list.
Representative Keel, my serious question was, why didn't it go to civil law, and why won't you just send it back to civil law right now so that they can actually look at whether or not it's the proper burden, who has that burden, what it should be, and whether or not it meets all the criteria that we do when we set up any other civil process, because that's what this is in the bill.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom. My understanding is, and it's probably not a simple or a good answer, but this bill is similar to the previous abortion licensure bill, and I don't believe it was requested to go to those committees. So, and it wasn't recommended. So,
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Keel, at this point, I'm not going to make a motion to send it back, but I'm certainly going to talk to Representative Scott because it really is within the jurisdiction of the committee, and she should hear it. And she's having a hearing next week, and so there isn't any reason she can't hear it.
Representative Liebling. Or Representative Carlson, did you want to step in now, or do you want?
No, I'll wait.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I won't repeat and echo and get involved in the insults from Representative Cornish that I just think are, you know, there's no need to sink to that level. But I just do want to point out that this bill was put forward and is always put forward as being about women's safety, and clearly it isn't. And we just heard that it isn't. And I just want to say that it's really about politicians telling women how they should make their decisions. And I, Representative, I won't even mention your name, but just to say that women should not be pushed to have abortions. But at the same time, when they decide that they need to have one, they should not have politicians step in and make it more dangerous and more expensive and more difficult for them to do so, because there's this bill would close the only Minnesota abortion clinic in greater Minnesota. And when you make it hard for women to get to a place where they can get a safe abortion, it means they're going to wait longer in many cases, which makes it more difficult, more dangerous, and more expensive. So, again, this is a bill that is not about women's safety. It just isn't. It's about abortion politics. So everybody's going to vote on this bill, or those of you who want to stop women from having abortions are going to vote for this bill. But just know, this bill does not protect women's health. It may prevent some women from having a safe and legal abortion, but it is not about protecting their health. It's just the opposite. It makes it more dangerous, more expensive for women to get a legal abortion.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had a question of perhaps staff, and this is a follow-up to Representative Wagenius's question, because if you followed this issue and legislation like this, I don't know if this is identical in some other states, been challenged in the courts. And those court cases are very expensive. And as some of you may know, I serve on State Government Finance Committee chaired by Representative Anderson. I don't have those numbers with me here today because I wasn't realizing we were going to get into a discussion of the Attorney General's office. But my recollection is that in the bill, there is a significant reduction to the Attorney General's budget. And so my question, I don't know if Mr. Marks would have that information with him or if maybe Representative Anderson remembers a lot of numbers in the bill. So if she doesn't, I wouldn't falter for that. But what the reduction was to the Attorney General's office, because this is the type of case that would probably, with both sides of the issue engaged, go all the way to the Supreme Court. And I agree with Representative Wagenius. I think there's a... If you look at what's happened in other states, the high degree of likelihood that it will be challenged on constitutional grounds.
Well, let's see.
So maybe if one of the two would have that?
Either Mr. Marks or Representative Anderson, do either of you know the number for Attorney General? Okay, Representative, I guess they don't have it at the moment, Representative Carlson. Representative Anderson is attempting to find it.
Okay, I don't know if others had questions, but if they find it before we vote, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, okay. Any other questions on the bill as amended? Members, I guess we don't have that information. Perhaps we can provide it to you after the meeting, Representative Carlson.
Or, yeah, well, Mr. you can Chairman, get it. Well, I've got it on my desk in my own office. I have the numbers from the other night when we passed out the state government finance bill. So if they don't have it at their fingertips, I can get that on my own. But I think it's probably a question that if the bill is voted out here today, that probably should be part of the discussion on the House floor. When you go all the way to the Supreme Court, whether it's state or federal, those are very expensive court cases. And for those of you that don't follow the Attorney General's role in the audience, I think all the members here would know, but the role of the Attorney General is to defend a state law that is passed. It's a requirement that they have. And so if it is challenged, they would have to defend it. And I think it would be very seldom that they would ever be in a situation where they wouldn't, but I'm not a history person on every court case, but I think that's the general rule, at least. There's a couple of attorneys on the committee that can say whether I'm right or wrong on that, but I think that's the role that they have to defend. So if we could get those numbers, or I'll get them before the House floor, then if they're not available now before you vote.
All right. Thank you. Representative Cornish.
I think we've had several severability clauses before, threats of lawsuits before. We've had, I think, our gun bill that we passed on the same subject went to court, was ruled unconstitutional, came back, and the Attorney General defended it then, and we didn't add any money or anything special to the bill. Everything worked out okay, so I don't see the big problem with this whole issue of the Attorney General's severability or lawsuits.
Okay. Well, members, seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 606, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. House File 606, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, next I'm going to take up the budget resolution. And members, we had a separate handout that came later of the budget resolution as it exists now, and so you should have that that shows as it was adopted and then amended on April 13th. You should have that in front of you. And members, I'm going to move the A21 amendment to the budget resolution. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask a question that is not directly related, but will be as you move to the next bill with what you're doing. Was this bill certified when it was reported out of committee? as being within its target?
When it moved out of the Jobs Committee, Representative Carlson?
The reason I asked was within its target.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, it was within its target, Mr. Marks tells me.
Well, I guess I had believed that. It would appear that way, but maybe I can ask, being that you're going to be having an amendment dealing with this very section. It says the target here, when I look at the spreadsheet, $330,900,000, and that's what's in the budget resolution. But then there's also, it says general fund impact below that of $1,570,000. And I'm just trying to see how those numbers interact with the bill being certified, because that may impact on what you want to do with the budget resolution if I'm following your other amendments that you want to do once the bill is before us. So was it, are we calculating that 1.5, and is it?
Representative Carlson, if you're looking at the spreadsheet, the spreadsheet is assuming that the amendments are adopted. Maybe I can refer to Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, the tracking sheet for the jobs bill, the top line says with amendment A69, that was an author's amendment, and it's a fairly, it moves money around in a number of places, and we thought it would be better to have the spreadsheet here that actually showed where the money moved around. So the spreadsheet that's in the folder has the author's amendment. It doesn't have the other amendment relating to broadband built into it. So the spreadsheet reflects, is showing 1570. That amount is included in this amendment, or is included in the amendment to the budget resolution. But we were trying to have a spreadsheet that would be helpful, that would actually show what the bill looked like with the author's amendment included in it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and that
Carlson
answers the question, because House rules would provide that when it leaves committee, it has to be certified as being within its target, and as we all know, it's the spreadsheet that is the certification, if I recall. Okay, so that's the difference then. That 1.57 plus the broadband will be part of the budget resolution change. That's why I was asking the question before we voted. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that issue up and clarifying that, Representative Carlson. So, yeah, members, what this would do in total is this would add $9,570,000 to the target for the jobs bill, House File 843, that's before us. And it consists of the $1,570,000 that's in the spreadsheet with the author's amendment, which we'll be taking up later, obviously, and then anticipating another amendment dealing with $8 million. But this particular amendment to the budget resolution merely increases the target for the Jobs Committee by $9,570,000. So is there a discussion to that amendment to the budget resolution? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment. I'm pleased that you're moving in the direction that we tried to get you to move when the budget resolution was adopted.
Well, Representative Carlson, when we adopted the original budget resolution, we left some $300 million on the bottom line. I know that was a little bit unprecedented, but we did that because, you know, I guess it's been my experience, and I know yours over the years, and probably just about everyone's in this room who's a member, that oftentimes fiscal notes move around, and you also learn new things as you're having further hearings about needs that may take place. You look at the Agriculture Committee and what's happening there right now with the outbreak of avian flu. We were going to bring up that bill earlier this week, but given the emergency situation and the rapidly evolving things that are happening there, we felt it was wise to wait another week, as they were having a hearing themselves on Thursday, so we could determine just exactly what the best response would be. And I would anticipate that when we do bring up the agriculture bill, that there will be some additional money we'll be asking people to put into the target for the agriculture bill to deal with that emergency. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I was serious with my comment earlier, but I think you summed it up in the concern we had at the time, because we always left money on the bottom line for the very reasons that you cite, but when you said that $330 million was unprecedented, that was our concern that night. that there was going to be some very tough targets and that something was going to have to be done at some point. And I actually had some compassion for you because I felt some of your chairs would be beating on your door. And I think that's maybe what we're seeing happening here. But thank you.
Well, my chairs are great chairs, but
I didn't mean that they weren't. I just know that they were under some stress.
Mr. Chairman?
Well, Representative Davids.
I didn't beat on your door. I just picked your lock.
Representative Mahoney.
And Mr. Chair and to Representative Carlson, I have a sneaky suspicion that the chair of this next, the author of this next bill was not beating on his door from comments that he made in committee. Thought he was pretty happy with this bill.
Other discussion to the budget resolution A21 amendment. Seeing no discussion, the chair will renew his motion to adopt the A21 amendment to the budget resolution. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A21 amendment is adopted. Members, Chair Garofalo, who is the author of the next bill, isn't in the room at the moment and apparently is temporarily delayed. And so I'm going to call a recess of the committee till 1:30.
Mr. Chairman of the Wild Plane?
They did last night. I don't think they are right now, Representative Carlson.
He was promptly attired when I saw him earlier today. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah. All right, members, we are recessed till 1:30. Members, I'm going to call the meeting back into order here. Representative Garofalo moves that House File 843 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Garofalo, I know we've got a few amendments. Some are technical, some aren't so technical. Do you want to take any of those, or do you want to go through and explain the bill first?
Mr. Chairman, the documents you have are reflected in the A69 amendment, so at this time I'll move the A69 amendment. And there are staff is advising me of some oral corrections that they are aware of that I should make as well to the A69 amendment that I'll incorporate in that. The first is on page 7, line 34. We delete the period. Then on page 8, line 1, we are deleting the 26 and inserting the number 25. And third and finally, a new provision is being added to the A69 amendment that on page 72, we will delete section 10 of the bill. And this conforms to the spreadsheets we have and is what the author's intent is before this committee. Mr. Chairman,
page 72, delete which section? 10, did you say?
Section 10 on page 72.
Okay. All right. We'll incorporate those changes into the A69 amendment. Representative Garofalo, do you have any other... why don't you go through the A69 amendment? Do you have anything else you want to add on that?
Mr. Chairman, it's primarily technical changes, but I will highlight some maybe larger items people may be interested in. First of all, the Office of Broadband Development is restored. This was something that we thought they could get their grants out that they had already administered by June 30th. Subsequent communication from them indicates they could not do that, so we're going to restore that office. In addition, there used to be a $1 million transfer from the Petro Fund into this bill. The chair was misinformed on the consequences of that action, so we have canceled that transfer and we've put it back in there. Again, there's some changes for the Alina Courage Kinney fix to allow them to continue to do what they're doing. There are some different technical definitions regarding the definition of a car and inserting motor vehicle. The redesign of the Renewable Development Fund to the Energy Fund, who's responsible for those obligations when it transfers in, make some changes to those. For another provision, they're changed now, getting rid of the words with the commission for and inserting for commission. Primarily technical stuff. If there was one item that
would maybe strike people's interest. Not that people want to talk about it, but it's going to be on. Yeah, so anyways, that's what the, those are mostly the sections in there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, discussion to the A69 amendment. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, quick question. That part that was incorporated into the amendment, I didn't quite pick up on what that was and whether that was substantive or not.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Garofalo.
Representative Carlson, there's been an agreement reached between the Department of Labor and Industry on the builders with regards to construction codes. This conforms to that agreement by deleting the language that's in the bill. Do you want to add on to it, Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and members, this is the energy performance code changes, and as Representative Garofalo said, there is an agreement. The bill had already stricken the appropriation that was made for rulemaking, and inadvertently the language was not stricken as well. So,
yeah, I just Representative Carlson wanted to double check. I've got you on TV, you know.
Oh, all right.
What that means is that with my hearing aids, that I can hear you better.
Oh, good.
Or I can hear him better, one or the other.
Good.
But he left his at home, he told us earlier.
All right.
No, seriously, that picks up the sounds and screens everything else. Technology is important. But thank you for revisiting that for me.
Sure, absolutely. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a variety of questions on the amendment, just asking for explanations of it. So, Representative Garofalo, on page 1 of the amendment, line 22, you're deleting 216C.417. That's Made in Minnesota Solar. What's that doing? Are we stopping Made in Minnesota Solar, and how does that affect any payments or that have been committed or encumbered?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, so you're looking at line 1.22 and then delete the A69 amendment, is that right?
Yes, the 1.22 on and the A69 amendment.
1.22, I believe.
Yeah, 1.22.
So what's happening, Representative Mahoney, is for those who are already in the the Made in Minnesota program, as we know it, is going to be expiring and going away. However, there are people who are on the existing program who have already signed up. Those commitments are going to be met. What this is right here is this is the new fund, the energy fund that we're creating up, and it has allowable uses for distributed generation, including rooftop solar, solar thermal, the 5 qualifying conditions we discussed before. My understanding is that this was just accidentally included in there, that it's not. Made in Minnesota is gone under this proposal, so it makes no sense to reference the statute that we actually are deleting.
And
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Chair Garofalo, the fact that you're deleting this will not affect anyone who's already in the program.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, that's
okay. It's only because it's supposed to be a hearing. I couldn't use that.
Representative Mahoney, did you have another question on the amendment?
I've got about 5 or 6, so if you want continue to come back. On page 2, line 17, you're defining low-income person. Are you just taking out the minority and spreading it out, spreading the money out? I think this is the Urban Initiative Grant or...
Right. What's page and line on the amendment?
Page 2.
Yep.
Line 17.
This one is in the Vogel bill as amended.
Right.
This was
Chair Garofalo.
We passed the Vogel bill. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, this is the Vogel language that we amended in committee. I believe that in the original draft, the amendment was not included in it.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Chair Garofalo, page 7, line 27, you're on page 115 of the bill, you're deleting subdivision 5.
Yep, and what Mr. Chairman.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, what that does is it deletes the open and statutory appropriation for storage, geothermal, wind, solar, thermal rebates. and makes it a direct appropriation on page 30.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
And then I suspect that ties in on page 7, on the same page, on line 33, and page 121, line 22 of the bill, you're deleting everything after the B and inserting the utility shall not make incentive payments under this section. Could you explain that piece?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, the intent of the author is that these incentive payments are now going through the Department of Commerce as they are going right now.
Can you introduce yourself and give us your testimony?
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Harriet Hendricks from House Fiscal Analysis. So what this language does on the amendment, line 7.33, it clarifies what obligations are still outstanding under the Renewable Development Fund that Xcel is paying, and it conforms it to the idea that any outstanding obligations will be paid by Xcel, and before revenue would come in to the new energy fund account. This language allows the utility to not make any more payments under this section, and inadvertently we deleted lines 23 to 26 on page 121 of the bill, and that should be actually lines 23 to 25.
We should make
an oral amendment.
No, we did that already.
We did that already. Okay, so we changed that to 25. So then it would actually, the full language would say that the utility shall not make any incentive payments under this section for applications received after the effective date of this bill, of the act.
Representative Mahoney.
Always good to have staff answer your questions before you get to them, because that was my next question. And then, actually, my last question on the amendment is on page 8, line 26, you're deleting the new language and inserting, upon petition by public utility if the commission determines. Could you explain that particular paragraph?
Sure. Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, as you may know, as part of the E21 working group, a broad array of stakeholders have been meeting with regards to the design of a new multi-year rate plan, sort of a 21st century model of regulation. This has involved environmental groups, efficiency groups, the utilities, and this is a language that's related to those conversations. So what happens is that if you have a federal, state, or regulatory action, you're basically allowed to capture the costs for that recovery instead of having to instead of making the utility eat it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions or comments on the A69 amendment? All right, members, seeing no further discussion, I'll Representative Garofalo renews his motion to adopt the A69 amendment. All in favor? I think those numbers were incorporated. The A69 amendment with the incorporations, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A69 amendment is adopted. Next, members, we've got the A71 amendment. Members, I'll move the A71 amendment. This is, I guess, I'm not sure if I'd call it a technical amendment, but it's a pretty non-controversial amendment that Mr. Marks brought to my attention. Basically, there are a number of references in the bill where money is appropriated, and basically the language says it's available until used, and this just puts an end date on it, so it just doesn't sit out there forever if it's not used, and it puts the end date out to the end of the next biennium. Any discussion of the A71 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A71 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A71 amendment is adopted. Next, members, we have the A74 amendment. And members, I don't know, Chair Garofalo, if you want me to move the A74 amendment, I'll move the A74 amendment. Members, what this does is It puts $8 million into the broadband development account, which would bring the bill up to a total of $10 million of broadband authorized. And then it makes a few changes to prioritize how the broadband money is distributed, basically having it prioritized for economic development in underserved areas. Members, is there any discussion to the A-74 amendment? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said economic development in underserved areas. How is that? Did I hear you correctly on that?
I believe you did, yes.
Okay. So this gives me no context. Tell me how much money we are going to need for these unserved areas in the state. Is the $8 million 10% of the money we need? Is it 1%? Is it 50%? I have no context here.
You know, I guess, Representative Wagenius, I don't know that number offhand. I guess I felt that we should have some additional money going into the broadband area. And I may ask Representative Gunther, who's worked in this area more than I, if he wants to weigh in on this. But in terms of the underserved versus the unserved, I know there was some criticism with the other broadband grants that were done last time that much of the money was spent on unserved areas with a great deal of money spent on a very small number of people. And while this doesn't say that you can't do unserved areas, the intent of it is the language is such that it would try to get us a better bang for the buck than we got out of the last broadband grants that we did. Representative Wagenius.
You talked a lot about the broad without answering my question. I mean, I think for us to know what this means is we need to know how much is the need out there. Is this 1%, 10%, 50% of the need? And that is a question that we ought to have the answer to.
Well, I guess I would just say, Representative Wagenius, I believe there's a significant need out there. I don't have a specific percentage for you. The other thing is, I do think that there are technological innovations taking place all the time that may obviate the need in some of these areas over time, and perhaps not all that many years. But at the same time, there are people waiting for broadband now that I think this would help, and so that's why I'm bringing the amendment forward. I don't have I can't give you a specific percentage like you're asking, though, Representative Wagenius. I don't know that number. Representative, I have Representative Mahoney and Carlson. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to answer Representative Wagenius's question, the Governor's Broadband Task Force came up with a dollar figure of $200 million to serve the needs of a border-to-border broadband. Last year's budget, we put $20 million in for 1 year, and I can't remember the exact miles that they got out of that and the matching funds they got from industry. This bill, your amendment, or I don't know if it's Representative Chair Garofalo's or Chair Knobloch's amendment.
It's my amendment.
Well, that makes sense then. I was kind of shocked that Representative Garofalo might have put an amendment like this in. So if you do the numbers, it's probably less than 5% of what the asking price is for a year. But I think you're doing $8 million over the biennium. At this point, you still have $300 million on the bottom line, so there's hope for Greater Minnesota. But this is certainly a measly piece, but that's to answer Representative Wagenius's question.
Thank you.
Well, I would say, Representative Mahoney, first, there is $2 million in the bill already, so that would bring us up to $10 million. And secondly, I guess I don't know what the division is between the underserved and the unserved areas, and this bill, by prioritizing the underserved area and looking more towards the economic development aspect, I think, again, gets us a much bigger bang for the buck. And I think we have to perhaps have a policy discussion before we talk about spending $200 million to potentially reach every last home in the state, especially if we do believe that there's some other wireless or other sorts of technologies that are going to be out there that are going to be able to reach them. If that wasn't the case, and I guess I was convinced that that wasn't the case, I might feel differently about it. Again, this is prioritizing the underserved areas, so I think in that sense the numbers are a little larger than maybe it would appear. But Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to your comments there, if I could.
Well, sure. All right. I know Representative Gunther, I gathered, had some more information on it, too. But sure, go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, we did have a very extensive policy decision on broadband, and we had a very extensive list of witnesses in Representative Garofalo's committee about broadband. And I'm happy to see $8 million. And the $2 million that you spoke to is not in broadband. It is an earmark out of the Minnesota Investment Fund, which I find interesting that it's an earmark for broadband for pretty much one city in the metro area. And broadband, these dollars in broadband were to serve greater Minnesota, not the urban area. So you really have $8 million for greater Minnesota and $2 million for urban Minnesota. So we did have a big, long policy discussion. And I think Representative Garofalo's bill got up to, in his committee, up to $180 million to be laid over. And we come up with $8 million, Mr. Chair. So, and then I'll let you go to Gunther, but I have a couple of questions about the unserved and underserved that you're talking about.
All right. Representative Gunther.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, broadband is truly an economic development engine that will help greater Minnesota in all unserved and underserved areas. And the thing about it is AT&T, the Minnesota executive of AT&T said they're going to spend $400 million on digital broadband in the next few areas. They're going to announce it right after session. Frontier Phone Company, my phone company, is getting a federal grant for $30 million a year for I don't know how many years to help with unserved and underserved areas in greater Minnesota that they handle. So there is money coming there, and there is a different technology coming there. And last session, or last time, the only time there was broadband funding happened in the House and Representative Mahoney's committee, and I was glad it did. And I think this year the governor recommended $30 million, the Senate $100 million, and we recommended $2 million. And now with your amendment, we got it up to $10 million. What the magic number is, I don't know, because we sure look stupid if AT&T and some of these other companies came up with a new technical innovation to handle those areas that are unserved and underserved that would not require the communities that are getting it or the companies in areas getting it, they have to pay 50%. If we get somebody company coming in there that will not have to have that happen, I think it would be a great plus for the whole state.
Representative Carlson, and say you should mention, Representative Mahoney, if the city you mentioned that is being talked about for the $2 million is the same one I'm thinking of, I guess I'd hardly describe it as urban. I mean, it's certainly in greater Minnesota. Representative
Maybe
Carlson?
Greek.
Representative Carlson. Yeah. Sorry, your name's already scratched out on my list, and I was like, now, who was it again? Representative
Carlson. No, Representative Mahoney covered the point I was going to make last spring, working with Representative Mahoney. With the supplemental bill, we had a lot of references to the task force report. He covered that, so thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. One of the things that I had observed before, and of course I know very little about all these associated technologies, but more than 10 years ago when I was on, I think, a CSG trip to Asia, you saw incredibly extensive, much more extensive than here, use of cell phones. And I wondered how the use of broadband kind of implies laying cables and stuff like that. And I wondered how the more extensive use of cables that we're doing these days has, I'm sorry, the more extensive use of cell phones that we're doing these days has affected this debate and this discussion.
Representative Gunther, would you like to respond to that?
I was also in China, and there certainly everybody had one of those in their ear, and I agree with that. We are doing everything wireless and digitally,
okay.
And I think that technology is here, finally reaching the United States, and I think it will have a big impact, especially in those areas that do not have something that, the areas that do have the appropriate speeds and ability to take care of our needs are. I know there's the largest rural co-op in Minnesota is in a little town of Truman. They were thinking about moving because they didn't have enough bandwidth. It's amazing what competition does. The town of Medelia came up with a deal, and all of a sudden Frontier Phone Company says, hey, we have the answer, we're supplying you, now we'll take care of you. It's amazing to me how the state and the people in the state seem to race to the right solutions, and I think we're doing that in Minnesota, and I don't want to spend $200 million in something that we don't have to. So I'm glad we're going a little slow. Maybe not as slow as we, fast as we should, but we're a little slower.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, it's a policy debate, and I won't get into that. I do have some questions on the amendment, Mr. Chair. I will say we had witnesses that spoke to the not being favorable of wireless and satellite, with relatively poignant examples, but as again, I won't get into that. I guess I have to ask you, on page 2, line 12, you're removing at speeds that meet a Federal Communication Commission's threshold of 4 megabytes per second download and 1 megabyte per second upload, and you replace it with as defined in section 116J.39. Mr. Chair, there are absolutely no definitions in 116J.39. None. There is no definition of an upload speed or a download speed. So what are you asking them to do? I have the statute book here. I'm sure you know somebody might want to read it, but
you know, maybe I can have you bring the statute book up to me so I can see that again, Representative Mahoney. And Mr. Mahoney, while I'm looking at that, I don't know if you have another question you'd like to ask.
Yeah, I've got a couple other questions.
All right, go ahead.
I'm wondering what the chair of the author of the bill thinks of this particular amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney.
Chair Garofalo.
You know, investment in technology infrastructure is a good thing that expands productivity, expands work, and gives diversity to our economy. The devil is always in the details about how it should be done and the manner that it's done. Those can produce significant return on investment, so they can end up being obsolete technological white elephants. There's a lot of big gap between the potential and the downside to it, Representative Mahoney.
To Mr.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Representative Garofalo, I won't belabor the point, but I know this is not your favorite amendment, and I am I'm impressed by your ability to sit quietly.
What is this amendment?
It's expanding broadband.
Yeah.
Sir, I see, Chair Garofalo, I see you've got someone next to you at the witness stand there. Is that someone that wanted to testify on a question of Mr. Mahoney's here?
This is Bob Eloff, M.D. He's from House Research.
All right. Okay, sorry, I'm new here again. I don't know them all. Sir, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I wanted to speak to Representative Mahoney's statement about 116J.39, and I'm forced to disagree with him. But in Subdivision 1, there are definitions, particularly Paragraph B, the definition of broadband or broadband service. And the part of it that's relevant to the A74 amendment is that broadband is defined as having transmission speeds that, at a minimum, meet the Federal Communications Commission definition for broadband. And that replaces lines on, as you can see, on lines 212 and 213 of the A74 amendment. Language is struck which says, at speeds that meet a Federal Communications Commission threshold of 4 megabits per second download and 1 megabit per second upload. That took the Federal Communications definition at the time this legislation was enacted. By referencing the definition in 116J.39, it will enable the definition of broadband to increase as the FCC does it, which they just did this January. And the new speed, according to the FCC, is 25 megabits per second.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Chair Knobloch, what you have just increased the download and the upload speeds for broadband service in Greater Minnesota by putting this particular amendment on. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Representative Mahoney.
And if those numbers change over the next 2 years or 10 years, those numbers would apply on any new project, Mr. Chair. Correct?
I believe that's the case, Representative Mahoney. I think the intent was that this is a fast-changing technological situation, and what was considered state-of-the-art 10 years ago is obviously different today.
Well, and here's the reason I want to be very, very clear with on the record language. The next underlying piece in your amendment, 218, in need of a broadband service to retain or create jobs or to promote significant economic growth, and you take out the unserved. So what you're doing is you're taking out the definition of who that limitation of service, and there is no economic growth. I need economic growth on the east side. So if I have enough sway in the bill, or I can hide something in a bill, I can make broadband service political. And you've just made this a political issue. So if a rural member or a suburban member was able to say, this will help economic development on 7th Street or on Main Street in Wilmer or wherever, that's what you've done.
Well, Representative Mahoney, I guess what I would say I'm doing with this amendment is trying to see that the money is spent in a way that best prioritizes the creation of jobs. I mean, before, it wasn't necessarily that. It was potentially going to only unserved areas, and certainly there are needs there, too. But as we look at using the money, I guess it was my intent to try to use it in a way that would, again, as I said, get us the most bang for the buck. And I guess if you're saying, well, that's a political process, I mean, I'm sure that there were people that said the way the money was distributed before was a political process, too, because there were decisions made as to where to give the money before as well. I mean, not everyone obviously got all the money that they wanted. So this is simply a way to try to get us the most bang for the buck and best promote economic growth.
Well, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Mahoney.
Actually, there were people trying to do what you were doing right here, and the fight was to unpoliticalize it and make it serve the unserved and the underserved. You just, with your amendment, you took all that work that all the people got, all the interested parties got together to assure that it would not be political, and you just made it political. So that's what you did, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted you to know that.
Okay.
Very good.
Other discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the A-74 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, the A-74 amendment is adopted.
Did you ask for a division?
Representative Garofalo, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think at this time I'll have House staff just do a very high-level brief overview of the finance target for this committee and the individual areas.
Hey, Representative Wagenius, while they're getting ready to do that, yes.
Just since we've been adopting amendments, and I just want to make sure I understand the previous amendment, particularly as it relates to the, there were a lot of language changes on pages 121 to 120, well, I get 123, but 121 to 122, if you could just succinctly say what the net result of all those changes were.
That's a question to Chair Garofalo. I guess Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Aguinas, are you referring to the 74 or 69 amendment?
Your 69 amendment.
All right. And what were the lines you were looking at, Representative Aguinas?
And you made on page 7 and 8 of the amendment, it talks about pages 121. There are four, five amendments there, and on page 122, there are three more. And I just would like very, not a lot of explanation, but just to succinctly tell us what the net result of those changes was.
Okay.
Chair Garofalo.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is, Representative Wagenius, on page 8 at the very top, we had an oral amendment to change that line with regards to the Excel Solar Rewards Program. After that, there is net metering changes to make sure that it's avoided cost going forward. Okay. Next is that we are clarifying the Department of Commerce obligation for future Made in Minnesota payments, because while the program's going away, for those people who did sign up for it in the last 2 years, we make it clear that the Department of Commerce would not be doing that. We delete the statutory appropriation for solar incentives, and we make it a direct appropriation. We fix the timing of the transfer of the solar thermal rebates. We also make a technical modification to the combined heat and power language, so that it introduces an efficiency threshold for qualifying projects that are found under federal regulations regarding the Public Utility Regulation Policy Act, and the cost recovery provision that Representative Mahoney asked me about earlier.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought the net metering was changed to avoided costs, and I just wanted to make sure I was correct about that.
All right. Chair Garofalo?
Well, no, the bill already has net metering for avoided costs, so no.
Well, Chair Garofalo, why don't you give us an overview of your bill, and then we can have further discussion about it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to defer to staff to cover the higher fiscal points, and I'm happy to. There's a lot of content in there. I'll be happy to answer members' questions.
Thank you. Ms. Hendricks?
Mr. Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll read off the spreadsheet. We don't have the highlighter up there, but that has at the top says tracking sheet, House File 843, the 2E, the second engrossment. Just wanted to point out that this does not include the newly adopted budget resolution with the increase of $9.57 million. But I'll highlight where that where we would see changes in the updated spreadsheet. The first page of this spreadsheet includes a summary of all the direct appropriations by agency and by fund, starting off on line one with the direct appropriation totals by agency from the general fund. So the first line, line two, Department of Employment Economic Development, that is a reduction in base of $16.125 million, but that would change with the now adopted amendment that would appropriate $8 million to broadband development grants. So that 16.125 change between that base and the House would change to 8.125. Going down the list, there is the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency with a reduction of about $10.5 million. Labor and industry going up by $876 million compared to base, $2.8 million increase for Explore Minnesota Tourism, Bureau of Mediation Service, a $900,000 reduction. Further down on line 10, Department of Commerce, an $8.245 million increase, and Public Utilities Commission at a $1.452 million reduction. That brings us to a total direct appropriations of for the biennium in this bill without the broadband amendment to $323,776,000. So that reduction is a reduction in base budget of $17,102,000, but with the broadband, it would be a $9.1 million reduction in general fund direct appropriations. No changes made to the statutory appropriations for two agencies. Changes in general fund revenue are listed below. One maybe to point out is line 32, for Commerce, there's a cancellation of the transfer that would go from the automobile theft prevention account to the general fund and now is going to the insurance fraud prevention account. That brings us to total general revenue changes of $1.9 to $1 million for the biennium. And a net general fund impact, and again, those are not including the latest updates or the latest amendments of $332,470,000. The original committee target that this committee, the GGEA, our Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee, the original target was $330,900,000 for the biennium, but again, that has just been changed to a committee target of $340,470,000. So with the additional broadband funds, the increase in target of $9.57 million covers both kind of the difference on line 45 as well as the additional appropriation. Below that are a direct appropriation total by funds. I won't go through those in detail, but then starting on page 2 and further, committee members will find the details by agency. I probably won't go through all of them, but just to kind of show that the first is the riders under different divisions within the departments, and under change items, members will find the changes that the bill makes, either in reductions in appropriations or otherwise new programs. And then all the way at the end of the spreadsheet, starting on line on page 10, line 596, members will find any changes in non-general fund revenue as well as changes in non-state fund expenditures and revenue on line 623 on page 11. If members have any questions or about specific items, I'm happy to answer those.
Any questions on the spreadsheet? Otherwise, I'll ask Chair Garofalo to go through the rest. Okay, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Garofalo, did you meet your target?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, as modified.
As amended.
Committee, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I see that you spend Representative Cornish's money from the Auto Theft Prevention Program, which has always been in public safety in the past, and now you change it to be somewhere else. So if I could get that some clarification, you're actually taking money from grants that are given to counties for the prosecution of auto theft and to law enforcement to recover vehicles that are stolen. And what are you doing with it in this bill?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, under current law, that one half of that is put into the general fund. What this bill does is it cancels that general fund transfer and instead directs it to the Department of Commerce, where it goes into the insurance fraud prevention account.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I could get some clarification, so you are not doing anything to the current auto theft prevention grants? You are simply taking money that was not currently being used, or was that the money that was allocated for auto theft prevention grants? I want to get a sense of whether you're going to make it harder to catch bad guys who steal cars, or if you're going to actually just take money that should have been going for catching bad guys who are stealing cars.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, the good thing is that technology is making it more and more difficult to steal cars, so that's a good news for all of us. But how those dollars are appropriated in the general fund, I do not know whether that's the funding source for it or not. What I will tell you is that this is money that used to be going into the general fund is now being directed to this account. Whether that's tied to those grants or not, I don't know if the grants for those are funded from the general fund. There's certainly, I'm not aware of any direct linkage.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yep. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Representative Cornish would answer a question.
You bet.
Representative Cornish, are you aware of whether or not the auto theft prevention grants are linked to the money that he's taking, or will you at least investigate whether or not the money that you spend on auto theft prevention is being taken by Representative Garofalo?
Representative Cornish.
I'll investigate the heck out of it.
Thank you.
I'm told that Mr. Marks may have some information on this. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, this bill redirects money that was being transferred from the auto theft prevention account to the general fund. It redirects that to a different account. It doesn't do anything with the money in the auto theft prevention account that was paying for the grants or the actual spending out of that account. So it's money that was transferred to the general fund and not tracked anywhere. I mean, it was just general fund revenue, and it's that's the money it's redirecting, and then it pays for the cost of the general fund losing that revenue. But it's directing what had been general money transferred to the general fund is directing it to a different account in a different fund.
Okay. Representative Cornish, I guess you don't have to investigate the heck out of it.
No, that's just what I was going to say. So.
All right. Seeing no further questions, Chair Garofalo, why don't you continue with your presentation on the bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think...
Okay. I'll go ahead.
It's Friday. It's sunny out. I have done an overview of the bill. I'm happy to answer members' questions about the bill.
Representative Carlson, then Wagenius.
Being at ease, Dan, I wanted to give him a chance to finish, but I could ask several questions, but what's happening with the Bureau of Mediation Services here?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chair and Representative, can you point me to a line on the spreadsheet? That way we're all looking at the same document.
I'm looking at the first page.
What line number?
Number 6.
Okay, so that's the top line.
Chair Garofalo.
If you look for the specific changes within that account, that'll be farther down in the spreadsheet, which should be on page 7. And Representative Carlson, I'm assuming you're referring to the change items in lines 407 through 414?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we are reducing those appropriations to those funds listed.
And I,
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess when I looked the spreadsheets over, but I guess when I see what's happening, I can read the numbers, but what's the impact of those?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear that one.
Representative Carlson, can you repeat yourself?
Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm asking what the, I didn't have the mic here, I'm asking why the change, what's happening, what's the impact of your numbers?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman.
I didn't hear any of Mr. Chairman of the testimony, so I want to know what's happening with the Bureau.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, the target for this committee budget previous to today's amendment was 23.5% lower than it was in the previous biennium. It's about $100 million reduction. So as part of that, we have to find service reductions and find areas where we can save money. As you may or may not know, the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution, there's been some good things said about that, but at the end of the day, you have to find the dollars to meet this committee's target. If you have other suggestions on how we could to meet that target, I certainly would be open to those suggestions, but at the end of the day, it's about dollars and cents.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that I can explore that further. Maybe I can talk with some other people. I was trying to figure out what the impact of that particular reduction is. We all know very well in this committee what the targets were. And we did provide alternatives, by the way, when we were dealing with the budget resolution. I don't think that really answers the question I was asking, but I'll wait and ask others then. Mr. Chairman, I did have another one I noticed here was, and it deals with the film board. What is the impact there? There's a $3 million reduction. Is that the appropriation, I guess, I'm asking Mr. Representative Garofalo, that we use to attract films from time to time? Is that what that $3 million reduction is?
Chair Garofalo.
Yeah, so this is like the incentives for Brad Pitt sort of stuff. And the film, the committee was pretty strong at a time that when we're looking to meet our target, that would be an elective investment. And we thought our dollars are better steered in other ways within the bill.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to belabor that one other than that's had a history of on again, off again. But when we have provided those funds, it has attracted some filmmakers to the state of Minnesota. And it's my understanding when the last, it's been several years since I dealt with the issue directly, well, not several, but probably four, that we have had a history of attracting some pretty major films as a result of that. And other states are putting much more into that activity than what what we are, and that filmmaking not only gives good publicity to Minnesota often, which would obviously not be the only reason, but it also creates employment and expenditures within the state of Minnesota. So some of us at least have always felt that that was a good investment from the standpoint of economic development, but I have a feeling that a certain senator will perk up on that one, so I'm not going to worry about it until you get into conference committee. Thank you.
I have Representative Wagenius, Liebling, and Mahoney.
Could I just respond to his
question? To that point? All right, sure. Representative Mahoney.
Representative Knobloch, thank you, and Representative Carlson. Actually, I don't think we heard a bill on the film board in committee, so I don't know how strongly it was, but my recollection is we did not hear a bill, and I got a whole list of ones that we didn't, so.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Garofalo, it's sort of hard to see you here through Representative Gunther. you want to escape, too. When we were in committee and you were talking about your subsidies to electric cars or people who buy electric cars, I asked the question why we were not doing the same thing for electric buses. And if I recall correctly, your answer to me was, well, that's not workable.
I think you could ask.
And yesterday I read in the Star Tribune about a Minnesota company with I was going to say shops, but that's not the right word. With big facilities in St. Cloud and Crookston, is coming to the Twin Cities to demonstrate its electric buses. So my question is, have you rethought your position on that? Well, let me start with that. Have you rethought your position on that?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gaines, no, I have not. Certainly as energy storage technology gets better and as it has a higher energy density level, there will continue to be improvements. However, for those vehicles that require high weight densities, require large amounts of power, the movement nationwide is towards conversions to natural gas. That's where you're given equal environmental benefit as well as longer life. I'll point you to the fact that Duluth is just right now in the midst of purchasing some electric buses up there, and my recollection is that the batteries, they have a quick charging system where they need to stop to charge every 30 to 35 minutes. So I don't know if that's the model type you're talking about. Certainly, we'll see where technology takes us, but right now, in terms of the conversions that are taking place across the country for both the operating cost and environmental benefit, on the passenger side, there seems to be more momentum towards the electric vehicle side of things. But on the heavy industrial, fleet vehicles, those very garbage trucks, buses, recycling haulers, the movement is towards natural gas.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking about providing subsidies to people who buy from industries that are not in this state, yet we have a good, strong bus manufacturing industry in this state, in Crookston and in St. Cloud. And so my question returns. Things are getting better, and we haven't even looked at these new models they're bringing down to demonstrate, I think it's this week. It seems to me that we should be purchasing from Minnesota facilities, and in any of these designs, just like the electric cars, they get better as folks purchase them. And we should be encouraging, if we're going to encourage manufacturers outside of this state, it seems to me that we should be encouraging manufacturers inside this state.
I know.
Okay, if
Representative Wagenius.
So I think it's time that we actually rethink this position. But the other thing I just wanted to bring up, and Representative Mahoney just alluded to it, could you share with the committee the number of items in your bill that came to the bill not as a bill or not in hearing, but just arrived?
Chair Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, as you know, as a member of the committee, the energy portion of the bill was shared with the public 12 days before it was introduced. It was actually posted in advance of the Easter recess, an unprecedented step to get public input. And we did that primarily because energy is a very complex area of public policy and wanted to make sure that people had the full Easter recess to review those materials. In addition, on Wednesday, when the energy articles were merged with the finance provisions in this bill, we had not one, not two, but three separate days of public hearings on that. Because of the integrated nature of the bill, it was very difficult to schedule hearings on just one provision. So, for example, if you look at the reforms we're making with the Renewable Development Fund and bringing that in-house, it's very difficult to just have a hearing on that without talking about the changes that we're making to the Energy Fund. Likewise, it's very difficult to discuss those two things without also talking about the reforms that we are making to net metering. And then fourth and finally, to talk about the changes we are making to our mandate system in Minnesota so that our energy is both cleaner and more affordable. And so that's why the model that I chose was to get that out there for more public disclosure, let people digest it over their Easter recess, and then have multiple days of hearings on it. Certainly a person can look at individual subject items in this bill and say that there was no hearing on them until the release date. However, there was ample time and ample public testimony over three separate days to take that testimony, Representative Aguinas, and I hope that other chairs follow that process going forward.
Representative Aguinas.
Well, thank you. I did appreciate looking at the bill over my Easter holiday, and I did do that. But that does not negate the ability for the public to discuss some of the issues in committee ahead of time so they just don't arrive fully grown in a bill that we have had an opportunity in committee to, for example, getting rid of the greenhouse gas emission goals. Nobody had any idea that was going to happen. That could have been a standalone discussion. So I think we have some problems with the public input on this bill and regret that that happened.
Members, I have Representative Liebling and Hillstrom next, but Representative Hornstein had previously approached me about someone that wanted to testify on the bill, and I've forgotten their name now, and so I want to recognize maybe Representative Hornstein can call them down. We don't normally want to encourage testimony in this committee since we have had testimony on a lot of issues prior to this, but at the same time, rules require us to take some if we're asked for it. And we haven't had anyone else who has asked to testify besides this individual, so I want to allow that testimony. Representative Hornstein, if you
Thank
could.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, Mr. Yeah. Chair. And I know that Sue Watlow Phillips from the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing is interested in speaking very briefly on this.
Yeah, Mr. Okay.
Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I had my hand up was simply to say that, you know, this is a big bill, and I have never sat on the committee. I'm sure that the public, if members of the public are watching, that they also don't know what's in this bill, and we haven't had a walkthrough of the bill. I don't know how the how you, Mr. Chair, want to phase this with the testifier, but I think it would be helpful to just simply ask Representative Garofalo to walk through the bill and just tell us what's in here. Maybe the testifier has something specific she wants to, she or he, I didn't hear who it was, wants to tell us about, but at some point I think that, that a lot of us would appreciate just simply being understanding what this bill does.
Well, Representative Liebling, it's absolutely your prerogative to ask for more of a explanation than has provided by the walkthrough of the fiscal information that's been done so far. And so I think what I'd like to do, since the testifier is already nearly at the stand, we can maybe ask her to testify, and then I'll go back to you, Representative Liebling, and we can have Chair Garofalo give us a further walkthrough. But ma'am, if you could come forward to the witness stand, and welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, and if you could give us your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would agree that there are a number of pieces in here that would be very helpful to have a further walkthrough. I'd like to just testify specifically on two areas. One bill that was not heard in committee, which is House File 997, which is Housing Opportunities Made Equitable. You've received a number of pieces of information over the last couple of days about that. It's a law that we passed last year and was voted in the House of Representatives 130-0 to begin to address the disparity in home ownership between white and non-white in this state. We were the worst in the country at the beginning of 2014. We now are the third worst, greatly due to the great work of groups in this room that have been working on providing housing opportunities, longer-term home ownership training, as well as the great work by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency in using some of their own resources in putting $10.65 million in 2014, fiscal year 2014, and $10.65 million into home law activities. But again, we are the third worst behind Vermont and South Dakota. And part of the issue is, if you take a look at the information that was handed to you, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, National Home Builders Association, the National Realtors Association, as well as the Minnesota Management and Budget, say that one of the major reasons that we're not growing as an economy is because we're not having more folks move into home ownership. And 40% of the emerging market that's ready to move into home ownership are people of color, Hispanic, Latino, and American Indians. And we need to provide a longer-term home ownership training opportunity and a little bit more flexible financing to make that happen. We know that we will, for every dollar that we put into long-term home ownership training, there's a $12 return. We also know that there's about a 2.5 times return for the dollars that we invest in the program. No defaults in homeowners, the hundreds that have already gone through this program. So it's a program that works, and the time is now to invest dollars into that. The other piece I'd like to briefly talk about is in regards to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency budget, and I certainly think that the agency could probably give a much better testimony than I can on that, and certainly encourage you to have them up and talk about that.
Yeah.
Certainly the impact of the housing cuts are significant. While we certainly think the Challenge Fund has been a very good way to get businesses involved in creating affordable rental in the community, the way the Challenge Fund, $10 million of the Challenge Fund with no income limits in this bill is really of great concern for us. It doesn't allow us to match with other federal resources, other state resources. It doesn't even require a local match to it. And we estimate, and again, the agency can speak much better than I can on this, is that that $10 million would probably create somewhere, if you just use the $10 million for creating housing, maybe somewhere between 20 and 50 units of housing. And we have real concerns about that. And then the other cuts that we're real concerned about are the cuts to the Family Homeless Prevention Program and the Housing Trust Fund Program. Now, the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program is cut by $1.3 million. What we usually spend as a provider in that program for many years as the Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing is that we spend less than $1,000 per family. So that means 1,300 families are not going to be prevented from becoming homeless. And what we're talking about with the Housing Trust Fund with the $2.4 million cut is probably somewhere between 500 and 600 households are not going to get rental assistance per year. Now, if all those families ended up in shelters, not even all, let's just say a portion of them end up in shelter, we're going to save $3.7 million by those cuts. We're going to spend as taxpayers between $10 and $15 million in people being in shelter. Not a good use of our tax dollars. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will, in my comments, encourage you to take a look at the Housing Opportunities Made Equitable bill. It is moving forward in the Senate finance, not certainly at the level we'd like to see it at, but it is moving there. And we certainly encourage you to really take a look at these cuts to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency budget. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, ma'am. Chair Garofalo, I'm wondering if you could provide a little bit more extensive review of the policy portions of the bill as was requested by Representative Lee.
Chair, Mr. Chairman, members, I assume that members don't want me to go through each section of the bill, do they? Or is that what members are asking me to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I guess, Chair Garofalo, I guess maybe what I would ask Representative Liebling is she was the one who made the request. Representative Liebling, perhaps you can ask Chair Garofalo what you are requesting.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I'm not asking, I'm not trying to waste time or just do something that's burdensome to you, far from it. But I think that, I mean, I don't know what is the most convenient way for you to organize the presentation. If going through the sections of the bill helps us to understand what the bill is doing and you choose to do it that way, that would be fine. But I think some explanation of kind of the major policy changes in the bill would be warranted. And certainly, you know, I'm certainly not very familiar with energy policy or even jobs policy for that matter. And I'm sure that many of the people who might be watching us probably aren't either, and would just kind of like to know what the major thrusts of your bill are, and you know what your policy direction is here, if you wouldn't mind. I mean, I think that's sure. This
you know, I know you've done a lot of work on this. I know this is an area that you've been deeply involved with for quite some time, and would just kind of like to know where you would like to take the state.
Well, Chair Garofalo, members, first I would direct you to the House Research Bill summary that has been provided to everyone in their packets, which does, I think, outline a lot of what's going on in the bill. I note in that summary there are 11 different articles. You know, perhaps one idea, Chair Garofalo, although you can approach this however you want, one idea might be to describe what's in each article. But I'll let you respond however you wish to Representative Liebling.
Sure. Well, Representative Carlson has a question, so...
Oh, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to what Representative Liebling pointed out, in response to a question that I had earlier, Representative Mahoney pointed out that there were some items in this bill, apparently, that were never heard in committee, as I understood it. And so, as he goes through, if he could at least identify... what has appeared in the bill for whatever reason that never had a hearing or was never a part of any other bill, apparently.
Well, Representative Carlson, I guess, are you speaking of things that didn't have a... I mean, Representative Garofalo mentioned something like 3 days of hearings they had on the bill and presumably items that were in the bill. Are you referencing something besides that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not... sure what I'm referencing other than when I asked about the film board.
Mm-hmm.
It was pointed out by one of our colleagues on the committee that there were items in the bill that had never had a hearing. It's one thing to have a bill posted and to have perhaps a general overview, but it's quite another to have had a hearing on some specific issues. That's all I'm asking, is if those could be pointed out as he walks through the bill, which items are in the bill that apparently are new relative to having had any hearings before the bill was put together.
Just as
a footnote to what Representative Liebling is asking through, I'm assuming as he walks through he can tell us this is new, it had a hearing or didn't have a hearing or whatever the case might be.
Okay, Chair Davids, to that point?
Well, to that point, Mr. Chairman, I guess I've got a quick question for Representative Garofalo. Was the bill we have before us heard in your committee and passed through your committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, before the amendment that the committee adopted today, yes.
Okay, so then Mr. Chairman and two members are saying didn't have a hearing. That's a false statement. It had a hearing, and it passed to this committee. This bill had a hearing.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
My good friend, Representative Davids, apparently didn't listen to what I said. I said any issues that appeared in the bill that had... prior to the bill being introduced, that appeared in the bill that hadn't had a hearing prior to that. There is a difference between a walkthrough like this with items that have appeared, and especially if they're substantive, and that's what we're really talking about, that have appeared where they're just part of a walkthrough like we're having today, as opposed to a hearing like Representative Davids has in his committee. He thoroughly hears every bill, and then the bill is put together, and then we have a walkthrough on the tax committee. That's the process that was we do, and I was left with the impression, at least when I asked about the film board, that apparently there weren't any hearings on the film board per se, and then there was language and numbers changes as a result of the film board. But I don't think I'm asking about anything complicated. I'm just saying, you know, whether there had been a prior hearing on a given issue as he walks through. I don't want to hold up the committee, as Representative Liebling pointed out, but she doesn't either.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure, Chair Garofalo.
I would just say that if the minority caucus is upset about some of the provisions that we put into this bill and then only had the 3 days in hearings on it, I can write an amendment to delete some of those provisions out of the bill. I can do that.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I am just soliciting information. I'm not saying I'm upset one way or the other. I can't be upset if I don't know.
Chair Garofalo, I think you've heard the different requests from people. I would say that, I mean, if there is something that is not put in the bill, I guess to me you don't necessarily need to have a hearing to not put something
no.
in the bill. But
But Chair Garofalo, I'll let you handle this and give us an overview as you wish based on the various questions you've heard.
Mr. Chairman, I thought Representative Davids covered it pretty clearly, but I will state it again that the energy provisions of this bill were released and were available to the public for input for almost 2 weeks. And then when the full bill was released on Wednesday, we heard not one, not two, but three separate days of testimony because of the interlinking nature of this bill. So this bill had numerous hearings, numerous public vetting. We literally sat and took public testimony until there was nobody there who wanted to talk anymore. When I hear people say that we didn't have a public hearing on it, I don't understand what they are saying, but I will go through the bill, and if my overview of the bill is not thorough enough, I am happy to continue to talk about it. My intent was to be respectful of senior members' time and to provide the top-level overview, but I can go into more I will go into the detail the committee wishes that I do, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Members, I see a few questions, but I think let's let Chair Garofalo go through the bill some more, and perhaps the questions will be answered. And then they aren't, I'll come back to those who have questions.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, that point. I thought this was a finance committee. I care about the numbers. I don't care about what he did for policy at this point. Of course, Greg Davids cares deeply.
Yes, he does.
About all things. But this is a finance committee. I don't want to hear about policy in this committee. I want to hear about numbers, money. That's what I care about. The policy has been debated a lot, and it will continue to debate. So I hope Chair Garofalo is not going to be going through policy this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
If I may on that point, I asked two questions earlier. Basically, I got a non-answer on both of those questions. And policy does drive the numbers. And the purpose that we're here for today is to understand a major appropriations bill. And there may be some things in here that aren't tied to any appropriation, but I assume that most of what's in the bill, if there's language dealing with what that appropriation number is, that would be defined as policy, but it's very much a part of understanding the fiscal impact of the bill. And when I asked both those questions, I quite honestly, and I was willing to accept it on the first one, I said I would check later on the Bureau of Mediation Services to see what the story was behind that reduction and what that meant for that agency. So there's, I assume, some policy other than just a tough target that drove the arrival at that number. I asked about the film board and got the same kind of an answer. And then another member of the committee pointed out that there were some issues in the bill that apparently hadn't had discussion before they appeared in the bill. But in all due respect to Representative David's comments, there is a tie between policy and appropriations, and that's what we should be looking at.
Okay. Chair Garofalo, let Chair Garofalo give us a further review of the bill, and then if people have questions, we can ask Chair Garofalo some more questions. Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, page 3, Article 1, Subdivision 2 contains the funding for the Minnesota Investment Fund. Contained with that, and that is a $2 million loan to construct a aircraft facility. This is a Cirrus facility up in Duluth. On page 4, this is a $2 million item also from the Minnesota Investment Fund. This will be awarded to communities that meet a specific list of criteria, not limited to the fact that they're currently receiving broadband service outages, that businesses are actually being lost, and that there have to be an agreement between the private and public partnership of that item. Next are the appropriations for the Minnesota Job Creation Fund, as well as the appropriations for contaminated site cleanup and development grants. In addition, under that, $700,000 each year from the remediation fund is contained in those provisions. There's $1.425 million allocated to a competitive grant program for business development. $4.1 million from the Job Skills Partnership is appropriated, and if that appropriation is not sufficient, the appropriation for other years is available. Next is a $1 million general fund grant to the Enterprise Minnesota, and of that, $750,000 will be used for the small growth proposal. We fund money for the Center for Rural Policy and Development in this bill. In addition, we have money here for the Workforce Housing Grants Pilot Program. In addition, there is $5 million total in fiscal years 16 and 17 for additional workforce housing programs. You'll notice line 6.23, fiscal years 16 and 17. This is a Gunther provision to allow for a grant to develop and implement on Southern and Southwestern Initiative for Collaboration Pilot Project. Moving on, the Business Development Center in Mankato is funded on page 7. This is on the middle of page 8. You'll see dollars are given to the neighborhood development centers for model outreach and training activities in greater Minnesota, a one-time appropriation. Within the Workforce Development Fund, we have the $3.2 million for the Competitive Grant Program, as well as $3.5 million in each year for the Workforce Development Fund for youth programming. There's $1 million for youth build, $200,000 for diversified industry, $2.848 million in the year is for Workforce Development Fund for the Youth Workforce Development Competitive Grant Program. So this is something that people would apply for. There's $1.5 million each year for the Fast Track Program. Next, you'll see that there's the appropriation for the OIC centers. There is an additional investment in OICs for the East Metro and St. Paul OIC, as well as the Indian OIC in Bemidji. You'll see that the there's the funds for the Boys and Girls Clubs. Money for the Big Brothers and Big Sisters. $2 million to a grant to the Minnesota High Tech Association for STEM internship opportunities. $500,000 to Resource Inc. You'll see there is a grant to the St. Cloud Area Somali Salvation Organization. Some report card requirements and workforce development to make sure we get the right metrics and right data and these funds are doing well. Money for the YWCA in St. Paul for training and job placement assistance. Twin Cities Rise. A customized training program that is developed for Central Lakes College, Minnesota West Community and Technical College, as well as South Central College. General support services for the Olmsted Implementation Office. The funding of portions of the Minnesota Trade Office, as well as the Vocational Rehabilitation Program funding. Section 4, we can move into Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. There's some language in there involving aspirational goals for the program. Next is the Challenge Grant Program, where what will happen is $5 million is prioritized out of this fund for workforce housing in specific communities that meet specific criteria that are listed on 17 and 18. In addition, we provide a floor and a ceiling there to make sure that that those monies are appropriate with a focus on workforce housing as well as in greater Minnesota. We modify the language to allow the financing of new modular homes and other additional mechanisms. You'll note that those are the appropriation allocations on page 19 for each geographic area and the priority specified which ones of those areas have. Move to page 20. This is the Housing Trust Fund appropriations, as well as the appropriations for rental assistance for the mentally ill. In addition, the Family Homeless Prevention appropriation. We see additional funds here for home ownership, as well as Affordable Rental Investment Fund. Additional dollars are put into the, here's the funding for the Housing Rehabilitation Program, as well as the Rental Rehabilitation Program. And Subdivision 10 is where we have home ownership education and training. You see the capacity building grants, and there's also funding for competitive grants so that the Commissioner of Housing Finance should establish a competitive grant program to serve women and children at risk of being homeless or who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, international abuse of marriage, or forced marriage. The Explore Minnesota Tourism Appropriation here. This is where the their funding comes from. The Department of Labor and Industries items that are listed here. Workman's Comp has a, from their funds, is a significant investment in technology to upgrade their worker compensation system. We move into labor standards and apprenticeship. This is the items that are funded in this portion of the bill. There's a workplace safety fund that you can see funds go to. Construction codes and services, you'll notice that there's a different number there. That's because we accepted the governor's budget recommendation on repealing or on temporarily reducing some license fees. Pleasure to work with Commissioner Peterson, and I'm happy to work with him on that. The Bureau of Mediation Services, you see their items here, as well as Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Here's the Department of Commerce appropriations for the section, as well as the Petroleum Tank Release Compensation Board, which, again, we modified that transfer, so it's not taking place. Page 29.27, you'll notice that there is $1.6 million to the Commissioner of Human Services to supplement the ongoing operational expenses for the Commission of the Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing in Minnesota. Funding for the Legislative Coordinating Commission for captioning of legislative coverage, as well as MnIT. There's the enforcement provisions. In the area of energy resources, this is the energy fund. This will be used for distributed generation incentive payments, $22 million in fiscal year 16, $23 million in 2017. $400,000 in each fiscal year from the energy fund would then be used for a business incubator and developer with the requirements of private sector contributions to meet that. And so that the goals of that accelerator program are listed in that section of the bill. In addition, moving now into page 32, there is a $7 million deposit from the general fund into the energy fund to help fund some of the other items that are listed in there. You'll see that there is a 10.
If I may, I'm not sure this is exactly what we were asking for. I kept referring to where there were substantive changes that would impact on the budget, and what we're getting now, with all due respect, is really basically just a walkthrough that we had by looking at the numbers. So maybe in the interest of time, if Representative Garofalo would be willing to just, as he goes through the bill, point out where there's substantive policy changes that are impacting on the budget. I think that's our role here. I don't think that we need to go through it. If, with all due respect, Representative Garofalo, I think we may have had a miscommunication in terms of what we may have been asking for here.
Well, Representative Carlson, I think these are certainly substantive expenditures and such, but if the feeling of the committee is that they want a higher level overview, we certainly probably can leave that up to Representative
Garofalo. That's what I was asking for, was a higher level overview and kind of an identification of what may have been new initiatives within here. But I'll leave it up to Representative Garofalo on how he wants to proceed.
Okay.
Basically, what kind of set this off was we went through the spreadsheet, and there was virtually no comment about a 200-page bill or whatever it is in terms of what was in the bill. And that, at least for me, was a bit of a red flag. So the best way to make sure we leave here with some basic understanding of what this bill is all about, what some of the substantive changes are to state policy that are impacting on the appropriation.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I've had the opportunity to serve in the Ways and Means for several terms here, and what we're doing here and what Representative Garofalo has done far exceeds anything that I've ever seen, including the time that you were chair as Ways and Means, Representative Carlson. And I think we're setting a new precedence, and be interested to see in future years when we hear bills in the Ways and Means Committee. This will certainly change how we operate in Ways and Means, and I know at least the last four time, 4 years, we haven't had people come and testify or do things like that to this extent that we're seeing here today. So this is a new precedence, and, you know, if people want to set a new precedence for the Ways and Means Committee, that will carry on to the future years, and that's just really interesting for me. So this is a new day, and I'll remember this moment. So thank you.
Okay, Representative Carlson, I'll let you respond to that. And then I do want to let Chair Garofalo continue his high-level presentation.
We've always had a general walkthrough of a major bill like this. That's just not an accurate comment. And I wasn't requesting the detail that he was going through. If he prefers to do it that way, that's fine. But I was interested in what there might be substantive changes in the bill that affect state policy and the numbers that are in the bill. That's what I was asking for, and not necessarily a line by line by the appropriations, because that's here. That, I think, has been the long history of the committee. And yes, Representative Anderson, we did have testimony from time to time, just as we did here today, both when you were in the majority and when we were in the majority. So that's an accurate statement. What the general policy was, we would ask if there was anybody that hadn't had an opportunity in a previous committee to testify, wanted to testify, just as you did here today. That was very, very open.
I'll tell you what, Mr. Chairman.
We're taking a lot of time, and I think if that helps, if you know, it's Representative Garofalo's bill, so however he wants to walk through it. But I, in the interest of time, was trying to say what is substantive in the bill. What are some of the substantive changes in state policy that impact on the budget, the bottom line? And that's all I was asking for. If you want to provide more than that,
25?
That's fine. And I'm not interested in setting any new precedent other than what we've done in the past.
Well, members, in the interest of time, as Representative Carlson mentioned, how about if we let Chair Garofalo continue to go through his bill?
At whatever level he chooses.
Chair Garofalo.
Okay, well, I heard Representative Carlson say whatever I choose, and I like that answer. That's a good one. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to kind of at a higher level overview then just pick out certain sections in the bill. I mean, obviously, you know, as the author of the bill, I think every provision is substantive and every part of it's nice. I was trying to do a courtesy to the committee. I know that it's a Friday and some members have to travel for the weekend. I know that this bill has been out there for over a week. Some members have had a lot of time to review it, and some members would even prefer to have their questions be to ask them on the House floor. But that being said, I'm happy to talk about this bill. Sometimes I talk about it too much, so I'll take another crack at it and just highlight some of the top level views. And if members want me to go more into more in depth on that, I'm happy to do that. If I'm going too much in depth, I'm happy to stop talking too. That's fine as well. A couple of things. First of all, in the area of tax relief, this bill provides almost $600 million in immediate tax relief to the businesses across state of Minnesota. Now, second of all, there are significant investments for workforce housing. For those that don't know, in many of our communities in greater Minnesota, there is a huge problem where we have a market breakdown. And quite simply, we have businesses that want to hire work. Go ahead.
Keep going, Representative.
Oh, no, we're going to answer questions as we go, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Garofalo, I think I would prefer that you finish going through the bill, and then we'll take people's questions, and then we can answer them after you've gone through your overview.
Okay. So, again, almost $600 million in unemployment insurance tax reductions for the small businesses of Minnesota. Second of all is that unprecedented investment in workforce housing coming from existing funds. For those that don't know, in greater Minnesota, they have a market breakdown. Thank you. A market breakdown where we have businesses that want to grow, they want to hire people, they have found the worker that they are interested in. The problem is there just simply isn't any workforce housing in that environment. Because of an abundance of government subsidized health care, government subsidized housing, it screws up the appraisal process. So what we're doing is sort of a surge, an investment in these communities to get the housing market jump started and running, and that gives us the opportunity to allow to get the market over there fixed.
Next is there's significant reform in energy legislation. The first thing we do is we take a look at some of the, we revisit some of these ideas that are out there. Number one is that clean hydro, going forward, new hydroelectricity will qualify as a renewable energy technology. The reason why it would qualify as a renewable energy technology is because it is a renewable energy technology. Second of all, under the previous solar mandate that was passed into law, there are a couple of provisions that are not providing value to taxpayers. One of those is that 10% of all solar installations have to be small scale. We took testimony in committee that showed that this provides, it spends more money with minimal environmental benefit. Utility scale solar and community scale solar reduce more pollution and do it at a lower price. In addition, we eliminate the cloquet carve out, the carve out for the Iron Range that exempted them from the solar costs. And then finally, with regards to that, if a utility makes a determination that they're able to get power that is just as clean as solar energy, just as affordable as solar energy, and it's if they can do that and do it at a cheaper price, then they have the flexibility to meet that requirement. In addition, for our munis and co-ops, we have net metering reform, and this ties into a more complex area of regulation, specifically this idea of when somebody has distributed generation and they're using the grid as a battery, who pays for it? Do they get to use it for free or shift the burden onto their neighbors, or do they have to pay a standby charge? Do they have to pay for using the grid? So we put together a uniquely Minnesota approach, and what it says is that those people are going to get their incentive payments. However, instead of it coming at the expense of funding our grid, we're going to make sure that we have it come from the state of Minnesota. And this way, it doesn't pit neighbors against each other and local opposition to distributed generation. In addition, there's a $45 million distributed generation incentive program that's put up for not just rooftop solar, but also for solar thermal, for small-scale wind, for energy storage, and geothermal. The Renewable Development Fund back in 2011 was something that was transferred, that Republican majorities tried to sort of insulate the politicians from it, let the professionals do it. Allocate those funds, and that worked for about a year. The subsequent session,
Representative Kahn.
If we could have a reference to what page in the bill we're on, it would be really helpful.
Okay, Representative Garofalo, please continue with your overview, but maybe
just
give us a reference on your page here and there.
Okay. if members want to turn to their hymnals and go to Article 9, Section 1.
You need to pray for that.
What?
Your hymnal. If you go to Article 9, Section 2, this is where we set up the Energy Fund account. You'll remember, Representative Kahn, that the Renewable Development Fund in 2011 went through significant reforms to insulate it from the legislature and to insulate it from political pressure. The subsequent year, the legislature passed and enacted a proposal to take $175 million out of that fund, primarily for rooftop solar as well as made in Minnesota solar. And whether people should have access to get those funds or not, reasonable people can disagree. But by taking it in, making it a fund of the state general fund, now this makes sure that all groups have access to compete for those dollars as opposed to a few politically connected ones. Going back to Representative Kahn, I'm looking for the natural gas vehicles and electric vehicles incentives because I know that you'd like those.
Delicious.
I just do not have the page numbers memorized, I'm sorry, but I'll find it in a second here.
Page 149.
If you go to 149, this is Section 8, Article 11, Section 8. This is where we have electric vehicle rebates. The focus of the energy policy in our committee was that energy should always be cleaner as well as cheaper. And in the past, we had to make a choice. We had to decide that if we wanted cleaner energy, we had to pay more. Likewise, if we wanted more affordable energy, then we had to pollute more. And because of breakthroughs in energy technology and because of advances in energy efficiency, that's just simply no longer the case. Now we can put forward some smart plans that allow us to pay less and pollute less. And one of the one of the programs in here is a $2,500 rebate for electric vehicles, which have a significant environmental benefit. While there are zero tailpipe emissions, obviously at some point there are emissions generated, but this program is limited to Xcel customers, and the majority of Xcel's energy sources come from carbon-free sources. And so as people convert from gas mobiles to electric vehicles, there's a significant environmental savings. And also what it does is it puts a little extra demand onto the grid, which is a good thing. That allows a larger rate base and allows more customers to be picking up more of the fixed costs of maintaining the grid. In addition, page 152, this is a provision from Representative Anzels, the competitive rate for energy-intensive, trade-exposed electric utility customers. Up in the Iron Range, in those heavy power-intensive industries, they've seen energy rates as high as 40 to 50% higher over the last couple of years. Now, there's various reasons that account for that, but the most important thing is that with the economic stress that we're seeing in northern Minnesota, they cannot have a cost structure on their energy that's out of whack with the rest of the nation and the world. And so this would allow them to petition to the Public Utilities Commission to make make that change. The bottom of 155 into 156, this is the natural gas vehicles and propane vehicles, and these are used as incentives to replace diesel-burning vehicles, those with high and heavy particulate matter, mostly in a fleet vehicle concept. And again, Representative Kahn, if you compare this to the existing incentive programs, these are reducing more pollution than under current law. In addition, they are more affordable than under current law, so it's something that the committee was enthusiastic about and liked. The beginning of Article...
Skipping over a part of the bill that I think has significant cost implications.
Okay, well, let's let Chair Garofalo finish his presentation, and then we'll put you on the list, and you can ask about your questions.
Well,
Chair Garofalo.
Well, I thought he was going through the important parts of the bill. So
I think he is.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the DFL, I am happy to answer questions on the sections of the bill that you want me to. I've been criticized for being too little. I was criticized for going too much in depth. Now I'm not talking about the stuff that individual members want me to talk about. Just tell me what you just ask me about the sections you want me to ask about, and I'll answer it.
Chair Garofalo, I'd like you to finish off your presentation as best as you can see fit, and then members can ask you either about things that you said or things they feel were left unsaid. Right. So please continue, Chair Garofalo.
Okay. I mean, I did try to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, keep trying. I know you're trying. I know you've been trying to do that so far, and I guess I would just ask that you continue on through the rest of your presentation, Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some other provisions that are in the bill. Representative Kahn, Article 6. Oh, so page 64.
What? Aren't we going backwards now?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the maybe a provision you were interested in. This is the two-tiered minimum wage. Maybe sometime you can tell the story of the legislature where this idea came from. Also, this includes the Dabney provision. This is the bill we debated on the House floor. Next, if you look at page 68, section 6, and this is the standardization of minimum wages. There's been a concern that Minneapolis or St. Paul may be subject to a higher minimum wage and therefore would not be able to compete with neighboring communities. And so this is a standardization. You know, right now we have a standardization that the minimum wage can't go below a certain level. This would make sure that it just keeps these things identical so that we don't have communities losing businesses to one another. So, Mr. Chairman, I've highlighted, I think, some of the items that I think are important in this bill. I think the focuses would be that workforce housing is a big winner in greater Minnesota. In addition, some big energy changes that are going to make energy cleaner as well as cheaper. And most importantly, it's going to have the legislature be an equal partner in all the state of Minnesota in Minnesota's energy future. So I'm happy to take questions, or if there's other sections of the bill that members wish me to address, I'm happy to talk about those as well.
All right. Members, now we'll take questions. Representative Kahn, let me recognize you first, and then I'll go to Representative Hillstrom and through the rest of the list.
Okay. The
question that I'm interested in, the issue that I'm interested in is Article 151. Well, problem with doing it this way is that it's hard to find them once you've lost them.
I learned that earlier.
We'll go back to you then, Representative Kahn. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. I've spoken to you about one of these issues. Representative Garofalo, I'm very much opposed to your repeal of my gold coin legislation that I passed. Members, this is one of those issues that wasn't even introduced as a bill this year, didn't have a hearing, and then was placed in the bill, and the only hearing that it got was when it was part of this greater omnibus hearing, or greater bill hearing in committee. So, Representative Garofalo, we've talked about it already. I've told you that I'm going to get you some information, but members, I'm very concerned about this. Regulation of gold coins has become very important and ultimately has resulted in folks ending up in federal prison as they're stealing money from our seniors. And so by undoing this, I think you're going to make it easier, once again, for people to scam our seniors. So, Representative Garofalo, I'll get you the information that you requested, and hopefully I'll have all the names before we get to the floor as I offer an amendment to take it out.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have one other piece. I just figure while I have the floor, I'll tell you about both of my issues. The second is I'm very opposed to the telecom deregulation that you have in your bill. And I believe that landlines are very important and they're a basic necessity for older Minnesotans. And members, contrary to what you're hearing from the telecom industry, landlines are not dead, and they are not a text message and email is not a good substitution for a landline. You can't call 911 with a text message. You can't call 911 with an email. Not in Minnesota. So, Representative Garofalo, what this is going to do is it's going to make it so that senior citizens who happen to live at the end of the farm row, the last one on the street, are not going to have the ability to have landlines because they're not going to be offered. And members, if you have seniors who have medical issues, many of the medical devices now have the ability to put the landline phone up to your medical device, like your pacemaker, and they can give readings and send them right to the hospital. You can't put a cell phone next to a pacemaker. Not if you want to live anyways. It's not recommended. So, Representative Garofalo, I think you have some serious public safety issues, and I think that you should take that out of your bill as well. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn, did you find the reference you wanted to ask about? Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Garofalo, I'm interested in Article 11, Section 13. Will you eliminate the nuclear moratorium that we've had in place for quite a while? In fact, one of the experts, one of the Customs Committee members, is sitting next to me at this time. And the, you know, I'm not... I'm not concerned, and I'll probably have an amendment at some later date, with relieving the nuclear moratorium as long as we put some conditions on the information that we need in place, which would not be a cost to the state because it would be, the way we would write it would probably totally require the power, whoever's proposing it, to do it. But the shocking thought that this could have no additional costs to the state, I would just ask you to look at the costs to the country of Japan that has recently, not recently, over the past 4 or 5 years, you know, because of nuclear power plants. So as I said, I don't object to some, to getting rid of the line that, the simple line that says new construction prohibited. But I do think we are required, when you look at what this is additional storage of spent nuclear fuel. I really think we have to put some language in on who and how that's going to be paid for and have some idea of it. So I tend, just warning in advance, I intend to have an amendment that would not bring back the moratorium, but would put sensible conditions on what construction could entail. I think we also look at the places in the country where new nuclear power plants are being constructed. I think it's in the southeastern part of the country. I think the costs have been unbelievably escalated. And I don't think that matters as long as those costs are all on the power company and they're not passed on to the consumers before the plant is even operative. But I just want to know what thought went. I noticed when you went through it, you totally skipped over that section, and I'd just like to know what thought went into deciding that this was a necessary thing to put into this bill at this time.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, a couple of points. First of all, each of the concerns you mentioned are 100% valid, and those are all concerns and questions that the Public Utilities Commission would make in part of their determination if a new power plant was going to be built. Second of all is that something that is different now compared to previous energy debates is that we now have, you know, proposed federal rules, which will go live this summer, which for the first time are going to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from new power plants and existing power plants. The Prairie Island and Monticello nuclear power plants will be, currently their license expire within 20 years. We're entering into the 15-year time frame, which may sound like a really long time, but when it comes to siting large generation, it's something that we need to be considering and considering now. And if Monticello and if Prairie Island are shut down, as technology exists today, and you merge that with the new greenhouse gas targets we have from the federal government, we're in trouble. I mean, you just cannot, there is no carbon-free base load power source other than nuclear, unless you count energy efficiency as a base load power source. But so that those are the factors that played into it. Representative Kahn, your points are absolutely valid. Certainly there's a lot of research going, you know, Bill Gates is putting a lot of money into this new sort of modular nuclear reactor thing, and we'll see if it has promise or not. But we're entering the time frame here where if Monticello and Prairie Island shut down, when we're running up against new emissions caps, we're not going to be able to build new baseload power. That's kind of the way we're heading towards, and that should be something that should be a pause for concern for all policymakers.
So,
Representative Kahn.
So, give me some. I suppose I should be able to figure it out myself from our rules, but some idea about when this bill will be on the floor and when amendments for this bill will be available. Because from what you've said, I actually will be very glad to bring you an amendment, which I will ask you to co-author with me.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think I would assume sometime next week I'll be on the floor, but I don't know which day.
Okay.
Okay.
Gives me at least the weekend to work on.
Representative Gunther, I had you on the list earlier. Did you still have something you wanted to say? Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, love Section 8. Thank you. Electric car rebates are very, oops, okay. Yeah, sorry. Can't say nice things from this end. I do appreciate that. But no, you'll like what I say now. But that's pretty much where it stopped. Nice. But the provision I would like to ask you about that I have some concern about is, I don't have the exact citation, but I understand that the bill has some provisions that may result in delaying some of the implementation of the renewable energy standard. And, you know, we passed in the House in 2013 a provision I authored that actually accelerated the renewable energy standard and increased some of the goals. And part of the rationale for that, and I think part of the reason the House passed that, is that the utilities are actually doing a pretty good job reaching those goals that we, on a very strong bipartisan vote, I want to remind the committee, in 2007 when we passed that standard, I think we had 110 members, something like that, vote for it, and Governor Pawlenty signed it. So this is good bipartisan policy that we implemented. And so my understanding is a utility can prove that their costs have increased, then they can reduce the time frame by which they're complying with this. And I just think that's a little bit arbitrary. I think our policy should be going in the opposite direction, which is the direction that the House passed a couple years ago, which is actually increasing the renewable energy standard. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, so I believe the section you're looking at here is page 127, lines 16 through 19. Is that the label you're talking about?
Yep. Okay.
And so what it says is that, you know, it's important to remember that each utility and each rate-paying organization in Minnesota is different. So, for example, Minnesota Power and Xcel Energy right now are far above the renewable energy targets, not because
correct.
It's being mandated, but because if you need to build new generation, the cheapest form, subsidies or no subsidies, the cheapest form of new generation, Representative Hornstein, is wind. And so that's why it's getting built. What this does is for those areas that are in a different situation than Minnesota Power or Xcel, and that really doesn't offer them that opportunity, we want to make sure that affordability is part of the dialogue. And so, as I mentioned earlier, there's some very energy-intensive industries that can suffer massive consequences from higher energy prices. And energy prices, for various reasons, have risen substantially for many of our power users across the state. And what this does is this recognizes that if this takes place, the situation where the activities under this section do require additional costs, that they're allowed to delay it. Now, I'll tell you, in its practical effect, Representative Hornstein, again, the largest power users in the state right now are already above that. It's not really an issue, but I understand your concern, and I think I would just ask people to be kind of aware of the fact that as we go forward, we want our energy to be both cleaner and more affordable.
Representative Hornstein?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that we need to be providing the incentives, the carrots and sticks for all utilities to be moving in the direction of renewables and implementing responsibilities under the renewable energy standard. And my concern is this does move us, I believe, in the other direction, and it kind of sends the wrong message. So that's a particular concern I have, and I agree with Representative Kahn on the nuclear moratorium. You had mentioned affordability, paying less for utilities. Nuclear power has been historically and remains, bar none, the most expensive way to generate new power. When you look at the, what does it represent, Con? You always talk about the Price-Anderson Act. You know, if you add up all of these externalities and the sheer capital costs of building one of these facilities and the mining and transportation of uranium and the fact that we don't even have a permanent repository for the waste, and, you know, Yucca Mountain is not happening. There's no plan to replace that, so it's going to keep piling up in Red Wing and near Monticello. So I just think it's that's another one where we're just sending the wrong message by lifting the moratorium. But those are my concerns, Mr. Chair, and I know members have other questions. So.
Representative Mahoney. You want to yield to Representative Kahn?
Actually, Mahoney. Mr. Chair, I will bring up one particular piece that was I'm kind of at a loss for the correct word, but I really made me uncomfortable. But it is a record for this particular bill, as far as I know, in the Jobs Committee, because Representative Gunther and I have both served on the Jobs for it seems almost forever, but. Earlier, I'm not even sure if they're still here, but earlier today I passed out a letter from the commissioners that this bill affects. And they had a total of 78 concerns or objections that they wrote about, and I've never known a bill out of our division that would have that many concerns with it. I know that the commissioners were all here because the governor had indicated that he wanted to make sure everyone knew where his concerns were with any bill, and this one in particular. So members, it was passed out. There was concerns from many different things. I know that either the commissioners or one of their representatives are here, and it covers deed. And, you know, when you took care of a bit of the border-to-border broadband, or the chair of this committee did, you know, it has issues on housing, economic development programs, trade offices, Bureau of Mediation Services, in the Commerce Division, it's got insurance regulation. It's got some investment issues. We've got all the energy pieces that the governor has seemed to want his commissioners to weigh in on. Members, there's any number of different issues in here. And again, the housing, I was kind of shocked. I think housing had, I did total them up. I think housing had 23 concerns with this particular bill at this point in time. Again, I'm not sure if the commissioners are here. I would suspect that the representatives are here. I would ask that members take a look at this particular letter. And if the commissioners are here and if people have questions about these particular issues, Mr. Chair, I would have hope that you would bring them down because, I took a look at this bill when it first came out. Representative Garofalo presented it in committee. And I read the first four pages. And I haven't been really concerned about it because, although the governor has not said this, I am pretty sure that this bill, if it landed on his desk, would be vetoed. And I haven't lost any sleep over this particular bill. Everything from the nuclear moratorium to housing concerns, to tip penalty bills, to the UI trust. You alluded to a $600 million business tax cuts in here. I can only track about $500 million, and what that is money out of the UI trust fund, which is how we're going to pay for unemployment. And if you read the reports from the uninsured, unemployment insurance groups, they're very concerned. They're very, very, very concerned. They believe that that is way over the top. They offered a compromise, and it was rejected. I could go on, but again, Mr. Chair, if I'll stop here for the time being. If the commissioners, if you want to call on any commissioners or people have questions about this, if they had a chance to look at it. But I want people to know, and I think the governor wants people to know, that he has concerns with this particular bill.
Representative Kahn.
Just a quick question back to the nuclear moratorium. Representative Garofalo, would you be willing to consider, as part of the amendment, getting rid of the Price-Anderson Act for the state of Minnesota?
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I would not.
It's a yes or no question.
He said no.
He answered.
Oh, no. Oh, okay.
Okay. Members, other discussion of the bill. We do have the letters provided by the commissioners that Representative Mahoney referenced. Members, we have had no testimony on this bill in Chair Garofalo's committee. I did take some testimony earlier from one individual that came forward and contacted a member who did want to testify. There was no one else that requested to testify before the start of the committee. I don't want to say that we're not going to take testimony if someone's got a burning question they want to ask someone, but at the same time, we don't try to rehash a lot of testimony that's already been done in other committees in this committee either. So, members, I want to be respectful both of those who have questions, but also of everyone else's time and the fact that this is already had, I know, a lot of other previous testimony. With that, members, are there other questions people would like to bring up or comments? Chair Garofalo? Oh, Representative Mahoney.
It doesn't look like there's any closing remarks, so I will have my closing remarks on this particular bill as I've sat through a number of hearings, some for bills in the bill and some not. But I did want to note that the Commissioner of Housing is here, the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Industry is here, the person running DEED is here, and the Bureau of Mediation Services are here. So these letters are very valid, and I certainly hope that as we move forward, we take these into consideration, and we don't just take it as another letter that landed on our desk and put it in the recycling before we really look at it.
Did you hear that?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. And Representative Garofalo, your committee has been interesting to be on. It has had some fun moments, some moments when you wanted to shut me down and you knew better. But I'm going to go over your bill. There's a little bit of policy, and I apologize for that, members, but I think the policy does drive the money. Members, this bill does not fund the job creation in the Minnesota Investment Fund at the level that the governor has requested. And Deed has used all the money that, and he didn't ask for anything more than was in the base. The job creation in the MIF fund created 4,000 jobs in this state. Family supporting living wage jobs. And pretty evenly split. A little heavier in the metro area, but about a 48-52, maybe 46-54%. I had to do rough math on my phone. So it was very evenly split, almost a little bit more than where the population centers are. You heard the woman testifying, your housing finance piece really does make huge concerns, and it reduces the number of housing units that are likely to be built rather than increase it, particularly for workforce housing, I should say. You did take care of the broadband a little bit, although I fully understand your concerns about that. But we heard testimony. I've had people in my office saying satellite and wireless is not where it needs to be for at least 20 and probably 30 years. So I don't think it's appropriate for Minnesota to stand still for 20, 30 years. And yes, there is a lot of federal money coming, but that was coming anyhow. And this $200 million is really what's needed above and beyond that federal money. You know, the Commerce Division had probably the longest, 40-plus issues that they are concerned about, everything from 43, from insurance concerns and how they are going to pay their investigators that say, yes, this is a good insurance policy and should be sold in the state of Minnesota. And we have a substantial insurance industry here, and we shouldn't be shortchanging that particular industry, and your bill does, because it does not pay their salaries, and these people will either have to be laid off or work for free. You kill off 3 out of the 4 trade offices in your bill. The last year, we've had a huge campaign on Greater Minnesota Business Development Infrastructure Grants. And we heard bills in your committee. We did hear bills on that in your committee that got pretty much about $20 million. And you gave just a little over 10% in cash, which is about a third of what was done last year under the Democrats. And I have yet to get an apology when they said that, well, I won't go there. I'll just let that go. The Workforce Development Fund. You took every dime. You left about $1 million in there. Now, we've taken money out of the Workforce Development Fund for job training, for this, for anything to do with how we train somebody. But we also match it with general fund. And you break the compact with business by doing what you did. you said that the state of Minnesota has no input, no skin in the game in this job training because you're using all this money that we typically use in case of layoffs. Or when people get laid off, they can go find retraining, whether you're 25 or 55. There will not be any money left in this fund. We have always left $10 million. You leave 1.3, I think it is. And you alluded to the that tax cut that you were going to do for business, which is really taking more money out of the UI trust funds. Again, failing workers in this state, whether it's through the Workforce Development Fund or taking money away from the UI Trust Fund. You know, I have a sneaky suspicion that the energy stuff will be debated on the House floor extensively. So I won't spend too much time on that. But Representative Garofalo, in your energy policy, and again, this is members, I want to apologize because I know this isn't a policy committee. There was no step to it. You just reached in, grabbed energy policy that we've worked on and done and pushed forward partisanly and bipartisanly, ripped it out and threw it to the side. That's fine. That's what I said this in committee. I'll say it again. You might want to go back and fund the Bureau of Mediation Services because I think that's the only way you're going to get some of your energy too. Because you're going to have to bring people together rather than just do it in your office with two or three people. And I don't know. I won't go there. Again, you put in tip penalty. You put in the statewide minimum wage, which really takes local control away. If a township or a city or a county wants to require a contract or people doing work for that city or that township or that county to pay a living wage with benefits and actually treat people with respect and give them sick time off or vacation time, they don't have that ability with your bill. You've taken local control. And you're the party of local control, I hear. At least that's what you say. Yes. Here's another good one. 87 news stories have been done about the unclaimed property. And you kept the unclaimed property language in your bill, but you took the money to pay for it out. Yeah, you did. So members, I can make a snide comment or I could make something silly here, but I'm not going to go down that particular road. I know I'm going to ask for a roll call on this vote, Mr. Chair, and I know how the result will be. It'll be somewhere 12, 17, 4, and 6 or 8 against, somewhere in that neck of the woods. And this will be debated on the floor, and it will be a long debate, and we'll have lots of other things. But as we move to the floor, as we move to the House, understand that the commissioners felt strongly enough about this that they wrote a letter, and they sat through one of these committees, willing to answer questions about your bill. And they had 78 concerns, and only one of them was minorly taken care of. Even if it was a negotiation ploy in this bill, it was a trade bait, we tend to call it. The Senate's going to take these four letters and say, whatever. So, members, I'm going to advise my members to vote against this particular bill, even though you did put $8 million in for broadband, which is almost an insult, but apparently not. You know, I well, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, it was fun to serve on the committee. Sorry I can't vote for your bill here, or unless there's significant major changes to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Garofalo.
Chair Garofalo, any closing comments?
Just Representative Mahoney, line 463 of the spreadsheet, you'll see the money for the unclaimed property. That's in there, so I didn't pick it out. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill provides significant tax relief, makes unprecedented investments in workforce housing, and it, most importantly, for the future of our state, it makes our energy system cleaner and cheaper. I'd ask for your support of this bill.
Members, see no further discussion. Chair Garofalo renews his motion that House File 843, as amended, be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Knobloch?
Aye.
Albright?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Carlson?
No.
Cornish?
Aye.
Davids?
Yes.
Dean? Detmer?
Aye.
Draskowski?
Aye.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hackbarth? Hamilton?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Hornstein?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Linjeski? Liebling? Loon?
Aye.
Mahoney?
No.
McNamara?
Aye.
Murphy?
Present.
Yes or no?
Present.
Okay. Nornis?
Aye.
Pulowski? Poppy? Torkelson?
Aye.
Hurdle?
Aye.
Wiginius?
No.
Members, there being 15 ayes, 6 nays, 1 abstention, the motion prevails. House 843, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a suggestion that I wanted to make. We had a pretty good discussion about what the expectations might be for the presentation of a bill. And maybe you and I can have some discussion about that. But the one thing that, and one of the reasons I raised the question I did, and we've got several major bills coming through, we all know that we pick up the newspaper sometime and one of the members of the House or the Senate here or in D.C. is quoted as saying, well, I didn't know that was in the bill. And that's why I think it's important that at least we touch on the highlights where there's major changes or initiatives when a bill is presented. But I'd be very willing to sit down and talk to you so that we have some understanding on both sides of the aisle what the expectation should be for the presentation of a bill, at least with the dealing of not only the numbers, which we did do very clearly here, but when there are initiatives that members should know about that are in a bill, that it should be presented in some way. And we do, both caucuses have our research briefs. We have members here today, and I assume your folks have theirs, which are very helpful, you know, when you're going through a bill. But it is important to also make some of those points as a part of the record. And that's all I want to say on that at this point. I was not being critical of Garofalo. I think he thought maybe we were, but that was not my intent. My intent was to try to solicit more information. But thank you.
Chair Carlson, I'd be happy to talk to you about that afterwards. Members, we have the committee next meeting at 1 o'clock on Monday, where we'll take up the higher education bill, public safety bill. If you've got amendments for those that you want to offer, please get them to us sometime in the next hour or so here. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned. Have a good weekend.
I thought you said 11:30. 1 o'clock.